Nancy Abrams, board member of the NRS.
Krish Bharatwam, executive director of the NRS.
And I'm Beto Sapello, group executive, Department of Science and Technology.
Just before you continue, I see the deputy minister is already with us here. I did announce that you were going to join us. Fortunately, you just came at the correct time. The deputy minister of Science and Technology is with us, and I'm sure you know him, all of you. Honorable Derek Hadeko. Okay, we can continue.
Patrick Thompson, executive director, Human Resources, NRS.
Eugene Lottring, executive director, responsible for innovation, NRS.
Marcel Pinar, NRS, corporate governance. Romila Maharaj, NRS, executive director for institutional capacity development.
Sashin Singh, the National Research Foundation, CFO.
Anita Ramsaran, the DST manager governance. Hello from DST.
Couldn't hear that, teacher.
Precious Tulos from DST.
Velimbele, DST.
Mumiso Khumei, DST. Mthabi Mawela, DST.
Yeah, we need to know what you are doing because we need to know whom to talk to and whom to refer to whenever we want to do business with DST. So if we are here, you must tell us what you are doing in DST so that we know that, or if it's a question of communication, we talk to you.
I'm the media liaison officer for Deputy Minister Anacom.
Derek Anacom, DST.
I have there the back my two secretaries, Beverly Walters, who looked after my office. They don't see you. The delegation must see you. With a yellow shirt. And then I've got Zelna Janssen with a white shirt at the corner there. She looks after the interests of our committee. And we have Chando, who looks after the interest of our party in things. There with a brown shirt. I don't know others, so I'll introduce the ones that I know. I think others are from the PMG, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, I think therefore we can continue with the business of the day. Professor Mongaso can then lead the discussion.
Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Sorry, before you go. We have this hall up to 12:30. So we must try to wind up our things by 12:30. So you, I don't know how you have organized your team, who will be presenting, and how many will be presenting, if at all. But what is important here is that you have from now up to 12 o'clock. You can present yourselves, and you have from 12:30, or even before that, if you can finish early, better, so that you can have time to interact with members. So we will have people there. So, yeah, thank you very much. People must switch off their cell phones so that we don't get disturbed on the way. Right, so we have the time, so we can give you up to 12, but the sooner you finish, the better, so that we have enough time for interaction amongst ourselves. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Member. This presentation is the business plan presentation of the National Research Foundation. The way we will do the presentation is I will lead the formal part of the presentation through a number of slides, at the conclusion of which we will open it for discussion and input from the various members, and the team here will respond to the various aspects that relate to their specific areas of expertise and responsibility within the NRF. And we welcome also any contributions that will come from the Department of Science and Technology, with whom we've been working closely in deriving this plan. We will try to take as little time of the formal time and allow enough time for the question and answer period. Hopefully we'll get to that. However, if there are any parts that members would like to stop me and interrupt, and so we can deliberate on those slides, that's also going to be okay. Well, the National Research Foundation, suffice it to say, we all know what it is. The National Research Foundation is unlike other science councils in that it doesn't have a product or a research output that it typically has, which is the case with the other more functional ones, such as the CSIR, the HSRC, which have very distinct products that can be measured in terms of success. The NRF is a success, is the success of the whole South African research community. So we act as a catalyst that promotes the, as you know, the chemical reaction without getting involved in it. We pride ourselves with the output that comes out of the constituencies, which are the universities, the research community, broadly defined in South Africa. So, beginning with where does the NRF get its mandate? It gets it from the NRF Act that was passed as an Act of Parliament a few years ago, and that is to promote and support research through those three elements of funding, the human resource development, the creation of knowledge, the facilitation of the creation of knowledge. That includes innovation and development in all fields. And then, as a result, we contribute to the improvement of the quality of life for all people of the Republic of South Africa. As I mentioned, there's no direct connection between the improvement of the quality of life and what we do with the NRF. It happens through various stages, but we believe that there's a significant contribution the NRF makes to that ultimate goal of the improvement of the quality of life for all the people of the Republic. There are several core missions, the four most important of which are the following here. The development of human resources within the country in sustainable numbers. The second one is the generation of high-quality knowledge in those areas that have been prioritized between ourselves and the DST, which is our line department, in line with those priorities. And then once that knowledge has been generated, we want the utilization of that knowledge through technology transfer, and especially the innovation. That's such a great catalyst for promoting the social quality, the quality of life in the Republic. And then, of course, the provision of infrastructure that is essentially in facilitating the development of that high-quality human resources and knowledge economy. We have several cross-cutting strategic priorities in the NRF, the primary of which are the promotion of equity and equality. This goes for gender, race, ability, and all other areas of equity and equality. While we do that, we also adhere to the highest standards of quality possible within the global environment. Speaking of which, the internalization of research is also an important aspect of what we do, especially focusing on Africa, because this is our continent, this is where we have our base. And if there's going to be any expertise in the world, it has to come from us on Africa. Positioning the NRF within the NSI, the National System of Innovation, is what drives economic quality and economic excellence, and we'd like to believe that the NRF is the engine of research in South Africa. Should be well positioned in that NSF spectrum. Within the organization, we have several points of transformation we'd like to accomplish. For example, the whole question of making efficient and effective the business processes and procedures that we apply, and the NRF is known for being the best in what it does using world benchmarks, whatever it is, be it granting, be it evaluating professors in the country, whatever it is, we do very well because it's a well-oiled machinery, but we want to keep improving that in consistent with the highest quality of TQM and other management procedures. The human resource question, the question of race, the question of gender, everyone knows in the room that there's a lot of work to be done in that area. And within the NRF itself, we like to believe that we strive to have equity in those areas. And then, of course, financial expertise, transparency, adhering to the policies of, you know, the general accepted accounting principles, those kinds of things. The organizational structure of the NRF is, as you see it here, with really at this point, we're looking at the Research, Innovation and Support Advances, the RISA we call it. And on the other hand, we have the National Research Facilities. In fact, SASTA, which is a sub-branch of RISA in there, we consider it to be a third leg of the NRF at this point by virtue of the work that it does. But that's how our layout is. And what is missing in that graph is the GMSA, Grant Management and Support Administration. Sorry, thank you. It should be under that core grant as the fourth leg over there. We should have another leg that comes down here that says GMSA. Well, I just would like to kick off by quoting our Minister of Science and Technology, Minister Musibudi Mangena, who spoke at the Conference on Human Resources for Knowledge Production in June 24, 2005, when he said that knowledge production is intimately linked to the provision of an economy supported by science and technology enhancing the daily lives of our people. So science and technology is a primary driver in this, and within that that space, we think that the biggest driver of them all is what we know as the PhD as a driver. The NRF has adopted this as a key driver for human resource development. We believe that the production of large numbers of high-quality PhDs is required as the bedrock for an innovative and entrepreneurial society. The question then becomes, how are we doing on that PhD as a driver? If you look at the world trends across the world, perhaps I should point this side so that the members of parliament, chair, can so I've been pointing over here. Probably the microphone is behind me now when I do this. Well, this doesn't work with the computer, unfortunately. Maybe I should use the mouse.
No, maybe what you can do, you can sit here and face that side.
The computer is here. I'll use the mouse like this. Yeah, I think it works, yeah. All right. Let me move the mouse to this side. And the microphone behind me here. Yeah, Chair, if you look at this... I can see... okay. I can see this screen and point that side. Okay, good. Yeah. All right. If you look at the trends around the world... Yeah, over. Yes. Yeah, this is the Department of Science and Technology. we should really know to connect this to the computer itself. But if you look at the trend throughout the world from 1999 through 2003, which is the latest year we could get global trends. In South Africa, we are able to get figures for later than this, but for comparative purposes, we couldn't get any figures later than this around the world. You see there are several leagues in which people are playing. In South Africa, we are currently in 2003, we're sitting at 23 PhDs per year per million of population right here. So if you want to know exactly how many we have, you have to multiply 23 by what's the population? 47 million? So 23 times 47 will give you something like 1,200 or something per year. Chair? That's very bad. That's very low, especially when you look over here. You know, it seems like we're, you know, maybe compared with Taiwan, which has a much smaller population, and you're comparing with Brazil, a much larger population than us.
But look at these trends in Japan. They are over 100 PhD per million of population, and with their population, which I think Japan is, over 100 million right now. And then you go to South Korea, which has a comparable population than us. But look at where they are. They started at the lower 100, but they are over 150 per million. And then the first world countries, the UK, you can see that there's a jump that went like this for the years 2001 and 2 and so on. And you look at the USA, it's there. And we didn't want to state here the actual figures because they'll be distorting us. You know, the best thing is to do it as a ratio. And the question you have is, are we satisfied with this? And the answer is always no, we're not satisfied with that. The question is, in which league do we want to play here? Do we want to play in the league with Taiwan and Brazil? By the way, China, it looks like that now, but I understand that the Chinese have invested a tremendous amount of money in there, and that figure has jumped up quite a bit. And based on the fact, of course, that China has over 1.3 billion people. So you can, that figure may be a little misnomer there. I think that here are the trends now. Which league do we want to play? Do we want to play in the China-India league, in which case all we need is a one-third fold decrease to go down there? Or do we want to get to the Brazil league, which is close to two, or Taiwan and so on? Or do we want to play in the Japan-US league with five to six? Korea, South Korea is ahead and forging even stronger. So where do we want to play? A lot of our colleagues have said that we want to play perhaps in the league of five-fold increase. And if we do that, ambitious target for South Africa is to achieve a five-fold increase in PhD output by 2024. All right? So if you look at that now, this is what we find ourselves. The additional investment required to produce 3,000 SET, science in engineering and technology PhDs, 1,000 per year by 2024, assuming that we want to have that 100% line, that goes with the red line trended here. That shows that by 2024, we'll be a little over 22.5 billion rand investment. That's additional investment over what we have. If we want to go to a 50% target, in other words, produce 1,500 FET PhD by 2024, then we want to be here on the yellow trended line here. In other words, produce, invest 0.85 billion rand by 2024. That's a lot of money to be invested. And right now, we are just far from there. In fact, if we continued our trend, we'll be sitting at the base of this graph throughout. So this is what we think we can do. By the way, how we got to this 3,000, we figure that we want to have 6,000 total PhDs by 2024, of which we estimate that 50% of them will be SET PhDs. So these are the trends we want to look at. This is serious business, and some measures will have to be put into place to inject a lot of money into our system in order for us to be players in the world, in this globalizing market that no one can escape. Now, one of the determinants of this throughput that keeps acts as a screening device, a block to us, is the whole question of the pipeline. If you look at the pipeline of PhDs which have resulted in that last year at 1,200 PhDs per year, you see that there's a screening that takes place at every one of the levels we have, starting from senior certificates with endorsement, you know, with exemption, or endorsement, supposed to be exemption. I thought in South Africa it's called endorsement. Okay, great. So if you take that number and look at the actual figures that were high-grade mathematics and science, of the 86,000 per year, 26,000 were actually science and math at high grade. And those translate to so many per year were graduating in that area, and then so many honors students per year, and then masters, including coursework, masters, 2,900 per year, and that yields 561 PhDs in SEMT per year of that 1,200. Now, if we want to step up our performance and come up to that 6,000 total PhDs per year by 2024, of which 2804 are SET PhDs by 2024, this is how much we need to step up our number of people coming through the pipeline. This is a 5-time increase of the pipeline at the same rates of yield. Of course, there are several other interventions that can be made to facilitate this pipeline growing bigger, or at least that the yield at each and every point becomes greater than what it is now. And we know the barriers that prevent people from converting from, say, matric to getting a bachelor's degree in science. How do we avoid those leakages that happen when people go out and go to work because of factors that are beyond their control? Of the ones that graduate with science, we have to find measures of making sure that it's attractive for them to go for higher education, for higher degrees beyond that. One of the problems, as we know, is the fact that the funding levels at this point, compared to what the students would get if they went into the marketplace, becomes a bit of a problem. Honors people, for example, I'm told, are funded at the level of 8,000 rand per year to do an honors degree. When someone can be offered 120,000 a year in a factory to perform in a laboratory, then clearly the 8,000 is no comparison for people who have families that were supporting them, you know, how our extended family structure is. I mean, the fact that you graduated in our situation is a team effort. It's an uncle and aunt and everybody around. So for you to, instead of going to make that income and help the family, you choose to go and do an honors at 8,000, becoming more of a burden to the family, and while things seem to be very selfish to yourself. So what we should do is intervene at this point by raising that bar at 8,000, maybe adding another 30, 40,000 for honor students to make it viable for them to take that choice. Unless we do that, ladies and gentlemen, our efforts are just going to fall flat on their faces. The same argument goes with going into a master's degree, which the burden is really even higher here. With lucrative offers people getting in the marketplace that cause them to leave the science system and thereby lessen that pipeline that we wanted to have. Let alone the fact that there are other kids in the system who might see them as role models to become attracted to science. So we have to really do serious work here, and the NRF, working very closely with the DST, has been working to come up with some very, very big interventions here. Of a large scale, and we have a delegation that's ready to go to the state next month to try to ratchet the thing to the next level. And we hope that in the near future, that trend will start, and we hope that by 2024, we will be very close to that target of 6,000 PhDs per year. The question of equity and redress, as expressed in the number of grant holders, is seen in this graph here. You can see that the tall blue bars are the total number of grant holders supported by this program. The light one signifies white grant holders, and the black one is total black grant holders. And as you can see over the years, the white grant holder number has been growing and has kind of... The actuals are around 1,000. Okay, we expect that to grow much slower in the coming years, because right now one of the problems we have is that the white part of our public of research community has been carrying the brunt of our publication. For example, white people, as you know, comprise less than 10% of the population, but they have shouldered close to 94-95% of the research output of the country. If we want to step up the research output of the country, then we have no choice but to tap very much into the unused portion, or the portion of the population that has had no access to that possibility. And that's the black population. And if you look at the total for blacks, you will see that it had a very modest increase until the actual this year. The provisional is still about at the same level as last year. But we expect that the projections indicate that it will grow for the next few years, to the point where it's almost, it's acceptable, but not quite there yet. We think that in the out years, we will see a much more significant growth, especially that pipeline we talked about starts to fill up. Of that, it's a portion of women that will be constituting the largest amount of growth we expect. Both women who are white and black women. And we can talk about these graphs in the discussions if members would like to. The research and quality development is the next area of focus, the RISA. This provides funding to rated and unrated researchers based on international best practices, as I said, of the ISO standards, the TQM, and so on and so forth. The output and productivity reviews are done through a rating system. We review proposals through panels, and so on and so forth. And we receive a number of grant applications, and actually there's too many of grant applications we receive that are meritorious enough to be funded. The problem is because of constraints of funding, worthy research proposals end up not being funded. Only half of them get funded. Not because we don't want to fund them, but because we don't have money. So worthy proposals still remain unfunded. And that doesn't bode well in the research community, because that remains a strike against the NRF not giving this funding. So it's an appeal that we need to raise our funds. So what are we doing to maximize the resource base? We have a division that's called the New Business Development here that's headed by the Executive Director, Dr. Rossis Kiev. We continually review and align our priorities with the national priorities as expressed by the DST. We fund focus areas. We cannot fund everything, so we have to really focus the areas we want to fund. And then, of course, the prioritization of current activities that have to be sustained, special programs such as Tutuka, and Dr. Maharaj can explain a little bit more, that's in her area, what impact that program of Tutuka has made on the historically disadvantaged community, on women researchers, and so on and so forth. We have research niche areas. We strike a balance between the number of grants and the grant value itself. We try to improve on internal efficiency in the grant making and management, as I've described. It's an ongoing, continuous improvement process. And that has led us to the point where the NRF can be considered to be a real transparent, fair, and balanced way of making those grant approvals. Improve on internal efficiencies in grant making. And of course, sometimes, because of the constraints we have on funding, we're forced sometimes to reduce the number of calls, the frequency of calls, where the funding is limited. For example, in the area of indigenous knowledge systems, we anticipate a shortfall of R500,000 because of the way the funding is structured, because of the fact that we've already made commitments to research as well, doing ongoing research on indigenous knowledge systems. Moving to the Innovation Fund, which is headed by Dr. Eugene Lottery. The Innovation Fund is one of those very important elements of the NRF in the value chain of moving from basic research all the way to the invention and the commercialization and the moving things into the product area, and thereby contribute directly to economic vitality in the country. But a lot of people sometimes don't understand how the innovation cycle moves and the higher risk nature of the investments involved. These graphs here show you, for example, in different areas, ICT, new materials, and biotechnology. You begin with investing a lot of funds in it that are sunk over time that you won't see, in this case, for 9 years, making an investment whose commercializability and economic positive cash flows start only in the out years. But you make a tremendous investment up front, knowing that at the end of the day, you'll make those returns. There's the area here that is called a sweet spot. That's where the venture capitalists will come and play in and put their matching funds, or sometimes I tell you, take this and go for a while, and we'll see you after a number of years when they expect their money to be paying back to you. So there's a lot of R&D that needs to be done in this time, and oftentimes we are told that we don't see where this money is going. We invested so much money. But that's the nature of long-range planning. That's the nature of this space that we play in the Innovation Fund. How does the Innovation Fund operate its affairs from day to day? Usually it begins with a pre-proposal phase where a few pages of a proposal are tabled. At that point, some screening is done. Okay, I need to go back previous. Oh, I guess this is an animated slide, so it will do it. It takes its own course. Site visits, full proposals. Then if they pass the previous stages, the full proposal is called for, and then a contract is issued. Here are some of the areas that, R&D projects that have been approved in 2006, 2007. Low-cost power source, that's the amount of investment in year one. That's the total investment anticipated. Industrial plant simulators, project pulp, laser paint, stripping, and so on. I mean, there's a whole bunch of them. Down at the bottom, the R&D project portfolio under management, there's 120 projects, a total value of $695 million. But the degree of understaffing we have within this area is represented by this. Only one manager runs all of this. And you can tell how much need there is for an increased injection of not only human resource capital, but also financial capital in this area of innovation. So in total, the challenges for RISA, this research support and innovation, are listed on this slide. The SACI chairs South African Research Chairs Initiative needs to be seen through and rolled out. We awarded 21 research chairs in the first round. We are aiming to have 210 research chairs by 2010. And so there's a lot of work that still needs to be done to identify areas of South African research chairs, and we hope that these research chairs will create nests around which young scientists and researchers can be spawned in a ripple effect that will spread around the country. We need to roll out the Centers of Excellence program that has been started. We had 9 of these originally, and of course others will be coming forth. The fine-tuning SRIP, to develop a SMME framework, the SRIP program has been designed for large companies for the most part, but its framework is now being presently adapted to suit the needs of small and medium enterprises. The NRF, as I said, is a very premier system for rating in South Africa, rating researchers. And over here, these researchers, from my perspective, it's one of the unique programs in the world where the country rates all its researchers in the country. But it's come to a point that the higher education of South Africa is now undertaking a review of the rating system to see how it can be improved and become better for the next years. The NRF is also involved with the National Equipment Program. This is a program whereby universities alone by themselves cannot afford a certain piece of equipment and look to the nation to support them, to get that equipment. And we have wrote some money into that with the help from the DST allocations. And that equipment program is very helpful to the university community. We want to be sure that it continues in its vitality. Streamlined and integrated grant application system, again, that's on an ongoing basis. The focus areas that we developed about 6-7 years ago is up for review by our evaluation center to see if those areas we identified as areas of focus are still relevant 6 years later. Or perhaps the question is this the way to arrange our funding formula? Or perhaps we should change to other funding formulas such as discipline-based, where we have the sciences, we have the mathematics, we have that rather than the focus areas. That will come out of that study. We need an exponential injection of funding into that innovation fund, ladies and gentlemen. I know because the pressures of showing results immediately is there always from the constituents. But if we are going to be a player in the national system of innovation, indeed if South Africa will be a player in the global family of economic countries, then we need to do some serious work there. The nanotechnology initiative got some funding from the DST, which is very welcome, and I'm sure there are many other initiatives that will come as a result of our trying to drive our economy up to the next level. I will move now to the South African Agency for Science and Technology Advancement, SASTA. SASTA is the arm of the NRF, or the leg of the NRF that does outreach to society as a whole to try to promote the glamour and the glitz of the of science and technology to youth. You'll see in some of the pictures the efforts that were made by SASTA to outreach several areas. Down at the bottom here was the astronomy quiz that took place at Hat Rau. Deputy Minister Hanekom gave a scintillating address in that to just excite the youngsters. These were primary school children who were asked several very complicated questions about astronomy. A total of 600 schools were involved throughout the nation, and 5 of them emerged to come to this competition here. And of the winning teams, as you can see, there were kids from all over the country, some from the Free State here, and this was a school from Newlands here in Cape Town, and one of the finalists was a school from Soshanguve in the Gauteng area, an all-black school, which to me, coming out of 600 schools, said something about the excitement that young kids can have. These are opportunities that should be multiplied many, many times, and this is Beverly Damonsi, the Managing Director of SASTA. The challenges for SASTA are to launch the first phase of the Johannesburg Observatory site, and of course the first phase was the feasibility study that has just been completed, and the phase 2 and phase 3 now is to do the physical work in that site. Planning for and designing the resources of the Life Sciences Center that's situated inside the Pretoria Zoo, based on the feasibility study. And of course, SASTA's mission is to communicate, to do outreach, and to do education about science, technology, and careers, and programs, and that sort of thing. Let's move to the third focus of this presentation, which is the National Facilities Infrastructure. I just want to remind the members here that what makes a national facility a national facility are these criteria here. The unique positioning in the South African knowledge production area, geographically, multi-user facilities, scale not affordable by an individual university. So that the nation invests in this capital to produce, to build its infrastructures so that the university community can have access to them in conducting their research and so on and so forth. Typically, these are large and unique science infrastructures for the research community. Technology and methods and data pools, collections of international standards that one university cannot afford on its own again, and goals and knowledge diffusions that are aligned with the objectives of the National System of Innovation, as pronounced in the R&D strategy and so on and so forth. And of course, where a critical mass of equipment is needed, and where facility centered scales and users congregate together. And these are things that have the ability to attract international collaborators. Chair, you saw the creation of SALT only a year ago that was launched in 2005. That's an example of how international collaborators get together. And right now we talk about the Square Kilometer Array, of which South Africa, along with Australia, are the two finalists to be awarded that. That's going to be a 1.5 billion euro injection to the country that wins. So we should have that. And no one institution can provide that wherewithal. Provide opportunities of research capacity development to the disadvantaged. As you know, in the scale of things, Chair, that it's mostly the disadvantaged communities that would typically not have access to this, even if a university could afford the scale of a facility. That is why these national facilities are important, to be put in the approximate access of all communities, both from advantaged and disadvantaged communities. And to do anything less than that will intervene and stop that flow of that pipeline we talked about. Then finally, platform for science advancement, education and outreach. Yes, when you talk about SALT, to look out in the skies, to look at the HMO and so on, the access throughout the year of different science communities through these outreach projects creates excitement among the next generation of learners who will then turn out to become some of the top scientists eventually. So that's the framework I'd like to for us to keep in mind as we look at each of these infrastructure facilities and what to do with them. The first one is the SAAO, the South African Astronomy Observatory. It's based here in Cape Town, but they have in Sunderland, that South African Large Telescope project that was, again, as I said, opened in 2005, operated by SAAO. One of a kind, the largest in the Southern Hemisphere. If you never visited Sutherland, I encourage you to go there because it's just amazing to be there. On a night when the skies are dark, you can see the far distant stars through those telescopes. What are the challenges for SAAO? The first one is to transform SAAO to operate that SALT facility optimally, proficiently, so that we get the observations that we wanted planned to do. To upgrade the Sutherland infrastructure, Sutherland is far from anywhere. And in order to attract good astronomers and future learners there, we have to have a strong infrastructure. There was a building there that was started, a recreational facility, which got left after the frame was, the roof was put and the floor was put, it was empty. Then we made some appeals for funding, and recently the DST has awarded money to upgrade that infrastructure, and that resulted in a very big boost in the morale of the astronomers there. And we'd like to see that continue in many other areas of infrastructure. Develop future South African user community in astrophysics and space sciences. This is the next generation, ladies and gentlemen, of scientists that we think by 2012 and beyond will then be able to be players who are qualified in this area. The NASP program is one of the programs that have been the nurturing ground for these future scientists, taking high school students, especially from disadvantaged backgrounds, and exposing them at the undergraduate level so that they get into honors and masters and then can become astrophysicists and space scientists later. AGAP is the other program that's being used here. Develop IoT infrastructure and exploit astrophysical virtual observatory bandwidth. I mean, the question of bandwidth, there's no doubt, Chair, that you're aware of the problems of bandwidth with getting those images in Sutherland and then having to relay it to different parts of the world where the analysis takes place, such as in Cape Town and overseas, will require a large amount of bandwidth, which right now acts as a bottleneck. And I'm sure, Chair, there's been talks across the disciplines here, across the directories and so on and so forth about getting that going. Contribute to SALT instrumentation development. Yeah, the spherical, you know, correction, it's a device, it's called SCA or what is it? Spherical Aberration Correction, yeah, SAC, that's the abbreviation, SAC. That has been playing around and not delivering, and some work is being done, and there are many other areas that need to be finalized in the instrumentation. That instrumentation is custom-made, by the way. It's not bought from the shelf, in which case the suppliers would have to fix it. It's fixed by our own researchers, and quite a challenge. It needs some money. Use of astronomy to enhance science education. Again, the glamour and the glitz of looking at the stars and the formation of the universe, the meteors and how the dinosaurs were killed. That's exciting to the next generation of scientists, and to the extent that you can bring it to their minds at an early stage will create that big pipeline we talked about. The next facility is the Hadrau facility, which has a 26 diameter radio telescope used as a single instrument in a global network of telescopes for very high resolution measures. And that's radio astronomy and space geodesy. These are the two areas that are being, done at Hadrau. What are the major challenges? Well, the major challenge here is the availability of senior scientists and engineers to continue with the current projects and to train students, especially in radio astronomy. We have the good fortune of being able to attract top scientists from abroad who do radio astronomy and can supervise the next generation of astronomers. For example, the managing director at Hadrao, Roy Booth, came from overseas. The managing director at SAO, Phil Charles, came from overseas and so on. But the idea is that we should create people from within the country, the next generation of our radio astronomers. And that has been quite a bit of a challenge. Most of the reasons we're told it's hard to get the next generation going is because of the lack of a pipeline. For example, for the SKA, we had a bid out to recruit people to do masters and PhDs in radio astronomy. And when you look at the profile, it's not very pleasing, because by 2012, when these people graduate, there's still going to be that void of people from disadvantaged backgrounds. And that's the concern we have at the NRF. I think we need to shake the trees. We need to get people who are bypassed by the sciences to convert back into the sciences. And I could go on this one. And Dr. Sitlapelo and Dr. Mdraka, when they looked at the profile of the people who were selected for that SKA program, were appalled about what the output. The fact that there were very few blacks in that list. And so we're working. The continuing work is ongoing there. And we'd ask for your support and suggestions how we do this. Space geodesy is the other thing that's going on within Hadrao, the new International Institute for Space Geodesy and Earth Observation, that is planned possibly for Matthew Fontaine, and their position of the space geodesy in an updated international network with an emphasis on Africa and the African crustal dynamics, and so on and so forth. The Hermanus Magnetic Observatory, which is not far from here, does near-Earth space environment analysis and research, which serves as a laboratory to do space physics, research, train full graduate students in space physics, and then, of course, understand and forecast space weather. These are the challenges that HMO provides: geomagnetic field, ionospheric and space environment data, and provide magnetic field-related services. There's a project that was called Ihlabathi, Core to Space, supposedly being one of those big science projects at the level of SALT and SKA done by at HMO. This year is the International Polar Year in the Antarctica, which South Africa is involved in. And in fact, the physicists of South Africa are now, and all the researchers, of course, are commemorating or celebrating this on the 1st of March. I understand there'll be a big bash all over the world, in Paris, in South Africa, and so on and so forth. To register HMO as a regional space weather warning center, a lot of accreditation has been leveled at HMO in terms of being one of the globally acceptable or approved, as far as standards are concerned, of space weather warning and so on. And then, of course, this year is a very important year at HMO, being the 75th year anniversary of its existence. The SAIB, South African Institute for Aquatic Biodiversity, their motto is the conservation and wise use of African aquatic biodiversity, as you can see from these pictures. In SAIB, the following are the challenges or progress that's been made there: to transfer the national fish collection to a new collection center that has been built right next to where it used to be, and then the refurbishment of the existing physical infrastructure within the old offices, the development of skills and human resource capacity for long-term viability of systematic research there, and then, of course, the creation of a sustained funding platform for ASAP. ASAP, this is the African Silicon Ecosystems Program. That's the one that was supposed to, well, we got a bit of funding, but we need to talk about how from in the future we can create a sustained funding platform for them. The development of knowledge management system for SAIB, ASAP, and SAON, Eloante, Coastal Inshore Modes. And the next one, I'll quickly move through these so we can have time to have a bit of discussion, ladies and gentlemen. This is the SAON. It's an observation. it's meant for the observation of environmental change over time and space, information management for science, management and policy development, and educational outreach. FAON is not quite a national facility yet, because this project has to be declared by the Minister of Science and Technology as such. That's why we call it an emerging national research facility. The challenges here are to continue to grow these nodes, to implement others, and then, of course, to implement information and management systems using open-source computational technology and expand the formal partner base both within South Africa, within the SADC countries, all of Africa, and, of course, internationally, and to develop core science plan and products. The zoo in Pretoria, their motto is the conservation of Africa's terrestrial biodiversity for sustainable development. Going forward, here are the challenges that the zoo is facing. Remember, the zoo used to be just a facility for keeping animals and having people come in and raising funds that way. That changed with the implementation of this new strategic plan, which called for the development of research, focusing on veterinary and conservation departments, and the creation of an infrastructure according to the new mission that was given to it when it became a national facility. We continue to develop research programs based on ex situ collections for in situ conservation of African biodiversity, and then, of course, we need to complete the capital project and start phase two of the establishment of the Life Sciences Center, as I stated before, which is the actual physical fixing of that Life Science Center. And, of course, finally, to align the human resources in the zoo with NRF policies and the new mandate. Itemba Labs, Laboratory for Accelerator-Based Sciences, that's what the Itemba Lab does, looks at subatomic nuclear science and applied radiation medicines with radioisotopes, radionuclear production, particle therapy, radiation biology, nuclear physics, and material science, and quite a range of things. And as you can see, there's an accelerator there. Again, the challenge is here to realize the medical radiation standard, the MRMC for radiation therapy, which is in progress, and quite a bit of interest has been put on that. We meet very frequently to realize that MRMC. To proactively manage the impact of the aging cyclotron equipment, to complete the integration of the Itemba Lab Scouting, which had been acquired, former Shonland Lab, to expand the IT and electronics capacity and acquire capacity to serve the university groups that wish to use international facilities, such as CERN, ILL, CBAF, and so on, overseas, and to seek new markets and develop new products. Again, as I said before, large facility, not any one university can afford it, but because of the fact that we've injected all this capital, many research people in South Africa, especially from developing communities, can have access to this. Now, the challenges of the national facilities, again, are sustainability in the long term. The consultation about, there has been talk about the creation of the South African Space Association Agency and its operations. What impact will this have on this on the national facilities? The Square Kilometer Array Management Team is right now at the project level. And how do we actually find a home, a management model for it, including, a viable accountability governance structure. The five-year research plans that we will take the lead from the Department of Science and Technology that will lead to some of the things we've talked about. The question of human resource development with a PhD is to optimize the use of facilities and structures across all contributors. The awareness in South African, in the South African student community of the importance of these big science projects that we have at our disposal, and of course the use of the science facilities for science outreach and community. The final area of focus would be the corporate and strategic issues here, Chair, and among these are human resources and transformation, gender-wise, race-wise, and so on, financial aspects, the governance issues, and of course corporate strategy and risk management. As far as human resource transformation is concerned, there are several internal challenges the NRF faces, and we can talk about these. The question of staff recruitment, We require high-powered staff at the NRS. How are we able to recruit them, retain them, so that they stay within the system and help out in the ways that we've described? And, of course, the succession planning. As, you know, the older generation phases out, how do we say we successfully plan for the next generation to take on? The question of salaries to total expenditure is something that we always scrutinize. The appropriate levels of staffing qualification and skill to achieve the goals. For example, the proportion of researchers to total staff is a very, very important question. And of course, we would like to believe that with the changing guard, we have myself and Albert von Jarsfeld and Krish at this moment at the presidential level of the organization. We've come with a different vision of culture than was the case in the old FRD and the first phase of the NRF. All of these are being talked through and being discussed among ourselves and the DSP, and we will spread it out to all the research community as we roll the rest of the year, and hopefully by the end of the year we'll unveil our new vision of the NRF, and hopefully along with that will be a culture change that involves touching as many of the community in the research of South Africa. As far as finances and sources of funding are concerned, Chair, you can see that we've had growth altogether. I believe the growth is estimated at 12% altogether. However, it's noteworthy to note that the blue shaded areas, these are the core grants from the DSP. That's growing at the rate of about 7% per year, 2006, as according to the latest MTEF. The ring-fenced and contract funding, you see in these paler ones, has been growing much bigger than that at the rate of 31%, altogether comprising 12% overall growth. So there is a bit of growth in our funding, but we're saying we can use more, and in fact, if possible, we are having engagement talks with Phil Mjwaka and Bertolt Tshapelo and all the group at the DSP to perhaps move out of the mold of ring-fencing the funds and allow the NRF to determine, once it's determined in strategies in line with the DSP priorities, to allow it to do the allocation as it sees appropriate to drive the National Science of Innovation and Sanity according to the mandate coming from the NRF Act. And Phil and Balfour will have agreed to that. Marginal increase on core budget is what I just talked about. We had also this problem of the post-retirement medical benefit liability that were, you know, we inherited. For example, it was a total of 89 million rand altogether. We are hoping to reduce this to zero through various ways, appealing to Treasury to fund this. The portion that will remain unfunded is still 41.1. We got some money from the DSC recently to reduce that 89 million to 41 million. We hope to bring it to zero by the end of 2009. The National Zoological Garden funding shortfall arising from the deficit on the transfer to the NRF amounted to 8 million rand, and that we still are in talks about getting help with that. We have to pay our rent at the SALT observatory there in order to get our share of observations there. The total that we're supposed to pay is 4.5 million. We received 3 million. So there's a shortfall of 1.5 million there, and to allow our researchers to do what they need to do. Limited room for infrastructure development in facilities. Most of the funding that we get for the infrastructure is mostly the maintenance, the ongoing operations, but there's no room at this point for developing and getting it to the next level, and that's something that remains a challenge. We still have governance challenges here. Over the year leading up to the point I was appointed in September, there has been amendments to the NRF Act, which up to this point has not been approved or voted on, and we'd like to see that process come to a conclusion to clarify our thinking in terms of our strategic planning. governance arrangements, the question of the innovation fund, which has been growing by leaps and bounds, is a question. There was talk of a foundation for technological innovation. So how does this fit? We regard innovation fund as part of the NRF, and there's an ongoing concern there. If there's going to be the FTI, then the NRF is engaging with the DST in creating a think tank that will be led by Devigan Naidu to think about possibilities that the innovation fund can be governed in the landscape of South Africa. I've mentioned the SASA, South African Space Agency strategy versus NRF inputs. What has happened here is there has been some thinking at the DST that now has started to involve input from the top professors, top astronomy professor, astrophysicists, to give input to the how SASA strategy can be constituted. And once the strategy has been conceived of, then a structure of how we put together the instruments that will enable SASA to happen. But that has been a very healthy start to have consultations around. The national facilities, we believe, are central to the national human resource development pipeline. And whatever of these arrangements take place, Chair, we believe that it is important to bear in mind the functionality, the importance, and the centrality of having those national facilities accessible to the larger community of South African researchers. The role clarification process, this is something perhaps which is you've heard before, Honorable Chair, the fact that the report that came to evaluate the NRF came out saying perhaps role clarification has to be clarified between the DST and NRF functioning. We believe that one does the policy creation and visualization and does the plan, and then of course the NRF kind of is the implementer of this. We believe that the NRF is and should be the agency of choice of carrying out some of these principles and policies. Now the question of the IKS unit, the Indigenous Knowledge Systems Unit, where you talk about the focus on Africa, developing research in the university base, has been in existence in the NRF for a while, and this is where perhaps our talks between us and DST will have to continue in terms of how this is constituted, what the vision of the DST is, and what the NRF's role can be as a mediator between the policy makers and actually the university community. The innovation fund governance issues I've mentioned, funding for research equipment, that national equipment program, and R&D infrastructure I mentioned. The DST and us have been talking about creating an overarching memorandum of understanding in the interim to consolidate or finish off the term whereby these ring fence funds have been used to drive what the NRF does. Perhaps phase it out by year three so that there's a lot more of the discretionary funding, the core funding that goes to the NRF. We are also awaiting an integrated plan that will come from the DST, which is based on a 10-year plan. That, of course, the DST has undertaken to initiate discussions with the Department of Education regarding the integration of research priorities and subsidy mechanisms that will feed that pipeline that will produce the 6,000 PhDs per year by 2024. It has to be a collaborative effort, and Philip Joachim, our DG, has undertaken to do that. So self-assessment and external evaluation of the NRF board performance is something that's ongoing right now, and we hope that by midpoint of the year we will have had an instrument done and the board will have been apprised in terms of what effectiveness measures need to be in place to make the board an effective organ to make sure that the NRF does its work and delivers to society. Finally, we're looking at the strategic issues about innovation system value chain, that there is the basic research that takes place at the universities that eventually ends up feeding into the wealth creation aspects through commercialization in a value chain that's supposed to act in a continuous, undisrupted way from left to right. And we believe that the NRF plays a very, very important part in linking this aspect and the front aspect through our innovation fund and all these instruments you see here. And we think that the national system of innovation will be served well by really consolidating these efforts and making sure that there are these necessary linkages between those that are university-based and those that are industry-based, so that whatever university research output gets translated into economic opportunities and therefore wealth creation for the nation. Currently, these are the structural arrangements of the NRF. We say that the NRF has three pillars: SASA, RISA, and the research and national facilities. But as the innovation fund, the I under RISA, has become robust and grown from having three employees when we took it over about 6 years ago to now about 37 employees, and the amount of money is still being handled through the innovation fund, we think that the time has come to have a rearrangement of this structure of the NRF to have four pillars. In other words, the FASTA and RFA, we dropped the I there and put the emphasis because of avoiding confusion with the previous abbreviation there. Then the provision of research facilities here, and here's the innovation. We think that's where it's going to be. With an independent, being an independent lab, probably led by a senior administrator at the top level there, these entities have vice presidents. We can see that having a vice president there, thereby unleashing the power of the innovation fund in a way that would benefit society much more. But at the same time, retaining those qualities of infrastructure, the continuation of thinking within the NRF, and the linkages to the research throughput through basic, the whole sequence I showed you in the earlier slide. But again, with the anticipated think tank, this will be one of the alternatives that's been put on the table. So the strategic issues continued here, corporate strategy and risk management. We will continue to position the NRF in the changing science landscape in South Africa, align it with the DST priorities in a dynamic and interactive way, with all those things listed here. And we look at creating new business exploration on an ongoing basis. And we look at ongoing strategic planning. And as I said, we hope to have a document out by September this year that maps out the whole question of strategic plans that can be anticipated from the NRF. And we believe that the NRF can be considered and should be considered as the agency of choice for the national system of innovation. With that, Chair, Honorable Chair, I'd like to say thank you very much for listening to us, and I would like to open this for any discussions you might have. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the very interesting input. I will allow members now to interact with you and share their ideas on your strategic plan. As usual, you will record the questions that are presented to you. You can share with your team as to how you are going to respond, and we can take it from there. I have Honorable Nxumalo Mokele. Those two at the moment. Then I will be the third one, because there are not many people.
Okay. Thank you, Chairperson. I take the opportunity to thank the presenter for elaborate and quite clear presentation. However, I have a few questions for clarity or for giving of thought. The business plan for 2007-2008, what is your 2006-2007 deliveries, especially in the fight against poverty? Just if you can give us quite a few there. The second question would be, there is a huge cry in the country of shortage of skills, especially in the built industry. What's your strategy to address this, or what is your effort to address this? The other question would be, 2007 is the year to intensify the struggle against poverty. But to your business plan presented here today, I didn't quite catch up with that. If you could just give us how your work for this year will address the poverty. In one of your slides, there's a Tutuga, which is, I don't know what the program or what, if somebody could elaborate on that, and the research on the Nguni Kaka, if somebody could give us something on that. Otherwise, for a while, and then we'll get for a second slide. Thank you.
Honorable Makar. Thank you, Chair. Thank you to the presenters. Let me just, from the outset, I'm a new member of this committee. I'm not a scientist, I'm not a technologist. And what's been presented to us today, much of it, I admit, is way over my head. The acronyms, many of them don't make sense to me, Jeff. I still need to unpack some of these things. But I'm on the learning curve. And at least I've always had an interest in science. Great lover of Jules Verne and the Arthur C. Clarke. And if that's interest in science, then that's where it should start. Because I think, Chair, that one of the strategic issues that has been raised is exciting people to become scientists and technologists. I think entertainment has done a lot to do so. I remember a time when the Department of Culture and the Department of Science and Technology worked quite closely together, and our entertainment industry in South Africa can play a big role in encouraging people. And I remember the major impact that those authors had on me. And wanting to become a scientist at one point, until I realized that my maths and science was not good enough, but that's another story. So the strategic issue of getting people into the centers of excellence, essentially, is what the objective is here. Identifying them at an early age, at secondary level, getting them through tertiary level. Do they have to, however, be PhDs? Do we really need PhDs? Now, ask the question. If one looks at the core skills that people say are short, they're technical skills. If you look at the mega projects like Kuche and obviously the 2010 infrastructure refurbishment of the well rig, refurbishing yards at Cape Town, Saldanha that have been planned, other projects, Gautrain, etc. Do we need PhDs for that, or do we need PhDs specifically for research? And I think we've got to separate the issues of what skills do we require to get the mega projects, keep them on track. What skills do we have to acquire, whether it be through GIPSA or conversion programs or acquisition of skills from abroad, from the skills that we require for research, our long-term vision to be world leaders in certain areas. And coming to your slide 40 and 41 then, I suppose we can't get to the wealth creation stage if we did not follow the previous steps correctly. And the previous steps, from what I understand you were saying, requires us to have done the basic research, apply the science and the technology, have the funding available to commercialize that technology further into a product or service. And when I saw you present it, it made me think of the way you've structured yourself and the governance issues you raise in both internally and externally. It seems to be so many agencies, and I want to understand how they fit together. To what extent are they working in silos? To what extent are they hierarchical? Whereas modern management theory would suggest the sort of open source collaborative approach versus the Microsoft approach, if I can put it that way. And if one looks at the way Linux developers talk about how they collaborate amongst each other in remote nodes, what management theory are you putting into this new four-tiered structure that you're proposing? Is it going to be hierarchical? I mean, the graphic looks a bit hierarchical, but I'm sure that wasn't your intention. But the four pillars for the NRF under the quality of life, yeah, there we go. Is there going to be a hierarchical approach, a silo approach, or are we looking at a more collaborative approach? And I don't want to be more specific than that, because how they fit together, this puzzle, is what's still new to me. And I hope by the next presentation in a year I would have been further up the learning curve. Thank you, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dan. In the absence of, at least for now, in the absence of further input, so I can seize the opportunity. Usually sometimes do not have the opportunity to table my questions because the time has been swallowed by other members, and members have to take priority. I shouldn't monopolize the seat of the chair. Yeah, actually, some of the questions that I wanted to put across have already been addressed by the previous speakers here. But I just wanted to find out, you see, we have to be very careful about talking about PhDs. If we talk about PhDs, we should exactly understand what we're trying to mean, because if you talk about we want to produce 6,000 PhDs per year, we can produce 6,000 PhDs per year. Well, I mean that we want to produce PhDs by 6,000 by 2024. But you see, if we produce PhDs that are not going to make an impact into our economy, into our growth, then it's an investment lost. You do not need too many PhDs to make a difference in economy. You only need to be very strategic in producing PhDs. Put all the resources to producing strategic PhDs that can make a difference immediately. And I think that is the line that was taken by South Koreans when we were in Japan. This is part of what they told us, how they broke through to where they are. So I'm therefore saying that what do you have in mind when you talk about quality PhD? Because I can be a quality PhD, say, in chemistry, because I was excellent, but without any strategy into the economy, it does not make any difference. We have many PhDs, actually. I know I've even passed on some PhDs to CSIR from very advanced institutions in the United States or elsewhere overseas, but they said they are not useful. So that is why, therefore, I am saying, therefore, if you are saying that talking about PhDs, are you talking about PhDs as PhDs? Quality has its own merit. Are they quality, but are they useful to what we are aiming at? That is the question. The next the next question out of that arises then. Have you, because you have got to do some good housekeeping before you even think about that, are you satisfied that you have convinced the state, the government, executive, parliament, because you need to have resources to do that. I'll give you a very simple case. You see, some of the best universities in the world, like Cambridge, like Oxford, like Harvard, there's a lot of resources that has been put to PhDs. Actually, if you go to Cambridge, the whole workstation and the way Cambridge works gives effect first to undergraduate students so that they can produce these quality students and they have the whole supportive system from the state, not only from the university, even from the state, with all type of resources. They are given multiple funds than many other universities by the state, and that is why they produce the type of personnel that they produce when people have gone through that pipeline. So, and therefore, you need to convince Honorable Minister Derek there, to convince the cabinet, to convince parliament, and to be sure that really we are on a good footing, we have the resources, then here are the programs, and then we put it. So, have you done that spade work? During the international joint workshop on education and science and technology, the president of the CSIR in India, Professor McGarg, gave a very good presentation, but in particular, he stressed that, which is what you hinted to his. I mean, some of us, the members, hinted that, you see, although you can produce these PhDs, but much remains on the ground, on the masses. If you have no strategy to develop innovation projects or strategies to sink into this mass, then you remain with your strategy for many years and many investors will pull out because you will not be producing meaningful results and poverty will continue to prevail and, you know, the offsprings of poverty, crime and other things probably. So you've got to also try and tap into how, because it is NRF which has got that particular strategic component to deal with diffusing technology and innovation into the mass, into the wider mass, which, as Professor McGregor called it, the PhD, what you're talking about, is just a tip of an iceberg. The real ice is in these masses. These are the masses. If we, when you convert, they quickly, immediately make a difference. And we had a presentation last week, for instance, from FLO, which was about the shortage of skills. You know, FLO came with a model that in Canada, they have a strategy of converting all the idling graduates, say, from social sciences, because it's easy to train such a person and convert him into an engineer, then to start afresh from invest in primary school, developing one mathematician and so on. But you see, you can convert somebody who already has an honors, somebody has got an honors in whatever, or psychology, can quickly convert that person into probably an engineer. And that is the strategy which Canadians are using, and they were saying that this is what we need to use to address some of these problems of technical skills. Yeah, I've got many of these guys. I'll come during the second round. Let me just leave you at that time, if you can respond to us.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. There was a whole range of questions that were leveled at us, and I will ask the members of my team to put in the areas of their expertise here. Just from my perspective, just to answer or to attempt to address the question of Honorable Ngumalo, which took notes down here. The first one was the fight against poverty. And the second one was addressing the skills shortage that, you know, have been mentioned. And then the whole question of the Tutuka Fund and how it plays up into the strategies that we're talking about. And I know that we have the colleague who can talk more directly about the Tutuka Fund and so on and so forth. Let me just preamble my remarks by just saying that, as I said in my original comments, that the NRF acts as a catalyst. It doesn't do things. It's unlike any of the other science councils, which will undertake research on its own. And instead, what we do is to fund. And sometimes our goal is poverty alleviation, improvement of quality of life. But this has a long trajectory of sequence of events happening until you get that final output. And the NRF is really at the baseline of all of this. We sustain people at the initial level of the trust that will lead up to the alleviation of poverty. That will be at the end, the product of that is the improvement of quality of life. So, just like we said about that innovation graph, that you have to sink some funds into at the beginning of the period. The output of it is not very easy to see right now. Tomorrow, as you mentioned, 2007 is the year that we fight poverty. We're not going to alleviate poverty in 2007. And in fact, if you look at it carefully, you're not going to see the direct linkage between the NRF and the alleviation of poverty. But the way that the NRF was structured, and I think this is contained in the Act and in what we do and in the report here, is that we will keep feeding at the bottom of that whole pyramid that Honorable Chair mentioned, so that at the end of the day, when people start to perform and feed back into the system, you look back and say, where did this all begin? And I'm sure there are stories all around us of people who can tell that the reason we're sitting here today is not because overnight I was able to get money somewhere. I got money from the Oppenheimer Bursary. I got money from the South African Council of Churches long ago. But if you ask the Council of Churches whether it would help the Mthimkhulu family in Ngqutu somewhere, they would say, no, we paid for that's all. He got the funding and he went to do some studies at Cornell and that sort of thing. So our aim is that eventually, the impact that the NRF is the seeds that the NRF is sowing will go a long way towards not only just improving the poverty situation, but laying the ground for a transformation completely of that the poverty that exists in the country. As far as the skills shortage, I'm sure my colleagues can add to what I'm saying here, in that we have certain areas that are being funded that have been targeted as the skills shortage area, that whose directives and guidelines were received from the Department of Labor, for example. And perhaps the colleagues here can elaborate a little bit on that, as well as the Tutuka Fund. Perhaps I should we should stay with this first set of questions that were leveled by Honorable Ngumalo here. Who would like to take on that question?
If I could just add to what our president has said. They say if you give a person fish, you feed one person. But if you train a person to fish, then you feed the whole family. And this is what the entire endeavor in science and technology training is all about. To train people so they are more readily employable, they are more readily self-employable also. And in that respect, we do address poverty alleviation. It also ties into the question of the skills shortage and what are we doing about it. There's enormous skills shortage covering the entire spectrum of the science, engineering, technology, as well as in commerce and social sciences. Under the DST, we just focus on the science and engineering and technology aspect. And the NRF
And again, this ties into the question posed by Conrad Lockel at the back. The structures in the NRF, are they silos, it's an interaction. The NRF activity spans the whole range. We have the one pillar of it is concerned with promotion of science in society, trying to bring home to people who regard science as a black magic box, to show them that it isn't so. That almost, well, virtually every community, every person in every community has the skills, has the aptitude to be a good scientist, a good engineer, a good technologist. And then at the other end, at the research facilities, we look at promoting top quality research. But we're also concerned with the entire range, from the family, the parent, the child, all the way to the accomplished researcher. And there are lots of interventions all the way along. What we are working on right now at the national facilities is on to set up undergraduate laboratories. Because nuclear science is a very expensive undertaking, and you cannot replicate the facilities that you require in every university, in every school. We want to place undergraduate teaching facilities at the national research centers and make it possible for the teachers from schools, make it possible from all the students from the far outlying universities to get to these facilities. So the entire range is catered for, and there's strong interaction between me as head of the research facility with Albert, who is the research support agency function, with Romila, where it is institutional capacity development, as well as with disaster activity. And at Eterma Labs itself, we see how can we get not the bigger universities that are closer to the facility, but universities from the far-lying regions involved in research at the labs to upgrade the level of the teaching there. We have joint appointments with the universities. We have strong funding available to get students and researchers to the facilities. So it spans the entire range that we're looking at. And the question that was asked, I mean, do we need all these PhD 6000? Let me stop there.
Yeah, I was suggesting that perhaps we should stay with the Honorable Nuwal at this point, and then we'll go to the other two sets of questions. If the members can just comment. There was a question about Tutuga, which Comrade Romila, you might want to. And the Nguni culture. Okay. Nguni kettle. Oh, is it Eugene, probably? Professor Watranjin.
You can promote it.
The Tutuka program was initiated in 2001, and we've just celebrated 5 years of six years of the program. It was initiated to address the difficulties that black researchers were experiencing in the historically white universities, because the NRF and other institutions had put in place programs for capacity building in the former historically disadvantaged institutions. And if you were a black researcher in a historically white university, you were really battling to get going. So that's where it had its origins. It has now evolved into a program that has three sub-programs. The first one focuses on all academics of all races that are employed in the higher education sector that need to obtain doctoral degrees, because one of the hurdles to developing research programs, in particular the comprehensive universities, the universities of technology, is the low levels of suitably qualified academics. And also in other disciplines, in even the well-resourced institutions. The second program looks specifically at developing women researchers at the postdoctoral level. And the third program focuses on developing black male researchers also at the postdoctoral level. It's also managed in a partnership with the institution, where the institution contributes two-thirds of the total funding. And the way it works is that individuals through the institutions will negotiate, submit applications, it goes through a review process. The reviewer's recommendations are then looked at together with the institution. So we then negotiate with the institution and say, this person is going to need X amount, you need to contribute two-thirds, we contribute one-third. And it's been an extremely successful program in its outputs and in developing researchers in these programs. I also have a booklet here that was prepared for the function, and we will leave copies for you.
Thank you, Dr. Maharaj. And in fact, that function was an extremely enjoyable and exciting one to see the output of what Chituka has been able to do over the years. And in fact, awards were given, and what impressed me most was with the tabulation of the points scored by researchers in terms of the number of publications, the number of honors students supported by this researcher, the number of master's students, blah, 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 all added together. The top candidate out of that whole heap who got an award that night was a young man by the name of, is it Binza, who comes from Tsotsimvaba. Young man, he has a master's degree, but he beat everybody out of a very big group of multiracial people from different colors. He got the top award for the night. I tell you, I was very spiritually elated and mentally excited to see this in front of my eyes. And Tutuka really, is it Binza? That's his name. Sibinza. Mr. Binza. Thank you. Dr. Lettering, please address the question of Linguni Kettle. Please, if you can.
I was one of those scientists who was still on the path to becoming a professor, but pulled out to go and manage science. I didn't quite make it there. The Green Capital Project is something that we're undertaking between the Agricultural Research Council and the CSIR. And it's largely the fact that the Guni cattle are known for their hardiness, and they are cattle that are predominantly in the southern African region. The physiology of the cattle makes them very interesting in terms of applications once we have the knowledge. So the investment in the project is to get an understanding as to how they are able to survive the hardy conditions in the southern African region. And once we have that knowledge, and apply it for agricultural purposes and commercial gain.
Thank you. I'll ask Professor Van Elsveld. I think I'm right this time. to talk to the question of TRIP, which is one of the programs that you'll see on the thing there that ties in well with the questions that Honorable Nuvalo was asking.
Thank you for the opportunity. TRIP is one of those very flagship programs in NRF, and it operates together with our partners, partners from the Department of Industry. Is that right? Trade and Industry. Sorry. Yeah. Thank you. And the objective here is to specifically, and I think the chair raised that issue as well. What strategy is behind the investment in terms of science investment? And the idea here is to specifically address the skill shortages in the country as they exist from a science and engineering in broader context. But what we do is we use the industry as a barometer. In other words, we don't sit in the office and decide what we think the skill shortages are. We go to industry and we say to industry, which are the areas of skill shortages that you are prepared to invest in? In other words, they really feel this is serious, otherwise they are the free. And what we then do is we put a mechanism in place that puts matching funding on the table. In other words, if they put a rand in, we'll put a rand in to the pot to allow them to get that training on the table. And by doing that, the Technology Human Resources for Industry program, and this is the interaction there. And so what we do is use industry as a barometer, we make a counter-investment, and we train large numbers of students, all the way from undergraduate students to honor students, to master students and eventually PhDs, because these PhDs will hopefully go and work in those industries. So we have a joint venture with industry to provide, try and provide in those areas where industry feels we have at this stage significant skill shortages. Of course, because we're training people throughout the process, we're not just starting with PhDs. I think the important issue is here that those students can leave the academic track at any time. In other words, after a third year or a fourth year, decide, I want to go and work in industry, and I've got an opportunity in textile industry, and I want to go and work there. So we're trying our level best to address, at least in partnership with industry, those areas that we at this stage feel we can fund and to make a contribution to.
Thank you very much, Albert. I guess at this point we'll look at the questions by the Honorable Lamarca, which I jotted a few down here. For example, you made the comment about exciting people, young people into science, and the question of whether do they have to be PhDs that are the output as the NRF is pronounced here. The third question was the question of the silos, the approach to doing some of the work we do. I think you mentioned the question of the science councils, which I take to mean other science councils such as the CSIR, the HSRC and so on versus the NRF working in isolation from each other. You also mentioned the question of the four pillars of the NRF. Again, giving the, you know, from the screen it appears like they might have the potential to work in a hierarchical, maybe structured silo approach. Well, I take the first comment to be a comment, really. The fact that we are trying to excite people to convert into science, and you mentioned some of the readings you had yourself that introduced you as a young person to the sciences. And in fact, those science fiction kind of movies and all that paved the way to what is currently happening. And part of our idea, especially with respect to SASTA, that outreach program, is to generate that in a much more real way now than the movies. For example, the museums of natural history have this attribute with them of trying to replicate the creation of the universe from when it began. And we're working with some of the partners, for example, the American Museum of Natural History, which is a partner in SOFT, has as part of its joining thought the collateral benefits of bringing with it some of their software that they've developed from empirical studies that were done by astrophysicists, estimating the times that it took to create the universe and what happened when the meteors hit the Earth and the dinosaurs kind of became extinct, and the possibilities of a future meteor hitting the Earth and extinguishing us or making us extinct. However, scientific work that's being done to try to defray that possibility from happening by creating some a spacecraft that can create enough magnetism to sidetrack this approaching meteor so that it's sufficiently deflected from its path that was going directly to the Earth, so it misses the Earth. But they simulate this in a real room like this that's created like, the space. I mean, we are in a planetarium. That way scientists, young minds, can be excited into wanting to do science. As I said, we did this with the science, with the astronomy quiz that Deputy Minister Hanekom addressed and came to address there. It's real. And it's stuff that when we grew up, we never got exposed to. And you see people that are like you taking in the lead in this, and then you want to become one of them. The question of do these students that we're teaching and helping out have to be PhDs is a very relevant one. But Albert Maniasos has just mentioned the fact that we have this as the ultimate goal, to have the PhD out there. But all along the trail, there's a whole big pyramid that it starts at the base where perhaps the output of the science system at the grade school level, at the primary, secondary, high school level. All along the way, these are people that we're trying to entice to look at the ultimate goal, which is the PhD. And anywhere along that value chain, there are branch off points where people can go and occupy critical places in the economy, whether it's in the laboratories, the labs only require bachelors or something like that,
or whether it's in the industry in the ways that have been described, or whether it's going back to teach at school, which you don't need a PhD for that. But the ultimate PhD is designed so that we can have proprietary, possession within ourselves of the knowledge that it will take to broaden the frontiers of science, to be able to generate the new generation, a future generation of people in these specific areas, than to have to rely on outsiders to develop ourselves. I'll give you an example. The University of Fort Hare, for a long time, after, you know, the new order came into being, did not have a PhD person trained in the field. I think it was sociology. As a result of that, they could not train any future PhDs because you could take the PhD person to supervise a PhD dissertation. And it's that ripple effect we're talking about here. So when you have those points of stars, whether they are 1,200 a year or they are 3,000 a year in a population base that's continuing to grow, you have those points of stars all over South Africa. That will then create that ripple effect that will end up with people settling at different levels of the hierarchy of knowledge, but capable of going right to the top at each one of them. So that's why the PhD is such an important indicator for us. The question of the silos, really shortly and quickly, is we encourage, while we design the pillars to be pillars as such, but for example, SASTA has cross-cutting functions. It reaches out to the facilities in the way that Professor Barusram just described, but it goes to the community, the science community. It goes to the various aspects of our function. It goes, it works very closely with the DST. That's an example of how we work. It's not just working in silos. We have forums that we meet periodically to share notes, to debrief each other in how we are doing, and go across, in a way that's sort of like a matrix kind of structure, if you understand what I'm saying. While we are reporting to the DST on one level, we talk to the university communities on another, and we talk with each other as colleagues at the same time. So it's that silo mentality we try, by all means, to try and break down and not encourage it to happen. We do talk with the other science councils. There's several forums. One of them that the Minister of Science and Technology has created is what is called that meets four times a year. It's a committee consisting of the chairs of the science councils, like the chair of the NRF, the chair of the CSIR, and so on. They meet periodically with the minister and, I believe, with the deputy minister. And so too do the CEOs and the presidents of these science councils meet to talk about things of common cause among them, so that we can share notes and create synergies among the functions that we handle, and also avoid duplication. If there's duplication, it must be strategically done to reinforce what we do. I don't know if the colleagues have something else to add here. Okay, thank you. But then finally, the line of questioning that came from yourself, Honorable Chair, was the whole question of the PhDs in economy again. And you mentioned the strategic use of PhDs as opposed to just producing PhDs as such. Use the example of chemistry. If you produce a PhD in chemistry, a person just goes to the lab, and what impact does it have on the system if you do it that way? And then the other question you mentioned was the question of convincing the rest of the funding agencies, especially the state, in the way that the states in America, for example, and other huge universities that make an impact get funded, but it's because they have a lot of backing from those who have the wherewithal to support them. You also mentioned the question of the human resources strategy and the spadework that it will take to create that, and the strategy to link the PhDs at the top with the rest of the tip of the, being the tip of the iceberg, with the rest of the base, which is everybody in the other levels. And of course, the conversion of those social scientists who are trained up to much honors level and so on, who are potentially trainable and convertible into science and technology and engineering and so on and so forth. These are very important things, and Chair, I take what you say with advisement, because I think a lot of it is as well as all the other comments, are meant to help us broaden our perspectives as we create our strategic plan. And so we have noted these, and the example of the PhD strategy of Korea is something that the colleagues are aware of, and we thank you for bringing, refreshing our memory on that. Is that the PhD we support is a targeted PhD. It's not any PhD, because it has to be tied with a strategy of what it is that we want to have as an outcome in the science system in the country. Only those PhDs that will contribute to that, based on the skills you know, identified in the plans that we get, will be supported. And so the question of convincing the state, we have had some discussions about this, and we are in the process of putting together a judgment right now that's called Quo Vadis NRF. And when that's completed, or even as it's being finalized, we are planning to do a roadshow as part of promoting the very objective we are talking about, of convincing all our stakeholders, the state, the university community, other science councils, and different departments within government, including education, trade and industry, labor, and so on, of the merit of what it is that we're trying to get to, and the need for that funding to come forward. Because we believe that once people are convinced about the merits of what we're trying to do for the country, people will be convinced, will want to be part of that success that we want to create. People will want to contribute generously to what it is that we're doing. And we're doing this in cahoots with the Department of Trade and Industry, which is our funding department. And I'm sorry, that was a Freudian slip. Minister Anikov, I'm very, very sorry. I hope the TVs will catch this correction. Sometimes people get taken out of the context. This is what he said. But yeah, the Department of Science and Technology is lockstep with us in this regard, and we will support each other and hopefully be able to deliver on that. The strategy PhD linked to the rest of the tip of the iceberg, or the ground, the work, the base of the iceberg. Yes, that's all part of what we plan to continue to do, and check ourselves every step of the way that are we still consistent with what we do? Are those stars that we've, the points of light we produced coming back to help out? And then, of course, our evaluation center is always helpful in indicating the extent to which these researchers keep contributing to the bigger objective. I find that, Chair, your comment about the conversion of the social scientists very, very interesting. I never thought of it that way. Part of what you say, though, I think makes sense, because I hate to personalize things, but I'd also like to personalize it right now. I was actually missed by the science system myself. I didn't do science and math in JC. That completely missed me out. And there are a few others who had that same situation, went through matric without math. But then, back in the days that we were going to school, they devised an extra year of high school, which was called a special course. That took all those people that had missed the science system over a year and kind of gave them an accelerated exposure to mathematics through all the years they missed. So that at the end of that, with an exemption that was based on social sciences, they were able to be refunneled back into the science system. So I think what you're talking about here is a similar version of this, only to more seasoned people at the bachelor's level, honors level, and so on and so forth. I think we should be thinking out of the box here and come up with these kinds of strategies in order to attain what we set ourselves to do. Thank you, Chair.
That is also how I came back into science. I also had missed it because of the situation. I do a special course in Mandarin theory to be back to science. Look at that, you see. So these things are possible, and that is what the Canadians are doing, and that is what this company of consultants was here and told us how to address some of these problems, because of course a very big bulk of community of students from historically disadvantaged South Africans who missed the science but who had the ability, who could still be converted back into science, and we stop howling and crying about the missed opportunities, because we still can convert them back. So I think these are some of the questions that you as NRF are supposed to be strategizing in your plans. Yeah, that's why I wanted just to bring that one to your attention. I have more hands now coming. I think the input is becoming very interesting, and more interesting incoming questions are coming up. I have Mr. Blanche there at the back. I've got the Honorable Nafogodo, I've got the Honorable Nyandu there in that order. I still have also some few nice questions for you. Oh, and then Honorable Numa.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Like yourself, sir, I'm not convinced that we should be concentrating on PhDs, because if I look at the graph, and that is on page 8, the PhD production profile. The USA graph shows that they've been stagnant for a number of years, while South Africa is at least increasing. If you look at the population of the United States and you compare that with South Africa, then 43 against 140 I don't think makes much of a difference for the size of the country. But the reason why I agree with you, Mr. Chairman, is I think our funding on innovation should be at the level where we are producing certain things. We are exceptionally good at this moment in the biofuels, not in the biofuels, but in the SASOF developments. And there were no real PhDs doing that development. Bill Gates, Bill Fenter were not PhDs, but look what they have done in the two countries where they came forth as developers in a technological field. And that's what I think we should be concentrating on in South Africa. After people have gone through their secondary education, they become really productive in their work, line of work that they are doing. And there's a number of these things that one can cite. The Sheffield Bogey, which was developed by the South African Railways, by Transport Department. The Creepy Crawley was a development out of South Africa, not by a PhD, but by somebody just at that level. And so one can name a number of these things. If you look at our farming community and compare them with the rest of Africa, I think we've got some PhD farmers, probably about 3,000 of them at the level of PhD, if you want to make that comparison. But they are extremely good at what they are doing, and they're doing it well. So I believe that if we do innovation funding, we should be doing at the level where people are just leaving the secondary school and going maybe into university, because there we need a lot of this kind of funding. If you look at the mining equipment that has been developed in South Africa, it wasn't developed by people with degrees. It was developed really by the people where we have skilled them. And there I think is what we need to concentrate. South Africans are extremely good innovators. And they start innovating as soon as they start leaving school. If you look at the youngsters coming out, becoming entrepreneurs, one is surprised at times at the things that they come forth with. And therefore, Mr. Chairman, I agree with you. I think we should have a second look at whether we want to really concentrate as much as the other countries on PhDs. If you look at these graphs, then I would say South Africa compares excellently with Taiwan. And if one looks at the UK, you ask the question, why did the UK stay for 2 years at the level virtually just double of that of South Africa? Have they not been getting imported PhDs into that country that now shows on their graph? And do we then want to compare with them? I don't believe it's necessary.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I've got two comments and questions. The first one is in relation to innovation and commercialization vis-a-vis accessibility of the information that came from an innovative process to poor communities. Now, I've always held a view that in our country there has been a system that made
all ideas that came from innovation, research, and funded ideas by our own funds, never been able to assist in the development of poor communities. Now, that is not out of our own fault. It's the past that we inherited. But I have come to the conclusion now that that still is the case. And if that is still the case, I think we've got to think very carefully. Because we are now wanting to innovate so that we can be able to get rid of poverty and other ills of our where our people. We are no longer just innovating in order to commercialize and someone gets money. And so the basis upon which the innovation fund has been constructed needs a review. I'm making that statement with reservation. But it needs a review in the sense that it shouldn't be the basis of an innovation program to commercialize only. Well, that's fine. It must be commercialized at one stage. But there must be an element of innovation that can assist in getting rid of some of the ills, and which means we should be able to, as I saw your slide, we should be able to invest, right, where we can be able to get rid of our people's problem. That's one level at which I thought we should adapt to. And whilst I'm still there, I haven't seen a process which goes out there to the disadvantaged community and pick up ideas that are innovative. I think we have taken for granted that the disadvantaged community, because of their situation, they can never be innovative. And therefore, because we don't interact with the day-to-day innovative ideas, we end up just depending again on maybe PhDs, whatever it is. But I think we must also be able to go and tap from many innovative ideas which come from the disadvantaged community. And unfortunately, most of us were not trained that way, including myself. We were not trained that way. We were trained the other way. And therefore, we are not able to pick up that which we must pick up because we do not have the spectacles to do so. But I think we must go there. The program that is there within the Department of Science and Technology of Indigenous Knowledge System might actually help us in getting there. There's a program now which is very encouraging. It might assist us in getting there in order to because those ideas will be consistent with the life of those people, and therefore we will be able to grapple with something we have never seen before. Now, my final comment lies here that we can have all these things of innovation. We can't do everything in the globalized world. We have to champion something that will make us competitive. Huh? I've always made a comment that more often than not, we tend to be very happy if a person is able to operate a computer and he operates it efficiently. We all clap hands and say, no, you have the basis of IT. Whilst actually, that person is operating something that someone else has developed, and therefore there's no other additional knowledge as far as I'm concerned. It is just the question of being able to operate the machine. Now, you can't be competitive if you decide to go that route. So there must be some niche that the South African community must get, which niche will be known to say, this, you go to South Africa, they are the best experts on this particular side of the story. Maybe the Nguni kettle. I'm really very pleased about that. Maybe the Nguni kettle, because then it will be something that is a niche. No one else is able to say
it worked this way or that. But even then, it was because we have been living in a fool's world. Nguni kettles have been there for millions of years, and people who have no more knowledge about them have been with them for years and years. So, but I don't want to get it. But I want to make this point here. We must have something that is our own and develop it very well. Targeted innovation, as the other people have said. I wanted to say something about TRIP. And I'm saying this from a privileged position. I was once one of those people who would sit as part of the evaluators of programs and projects of TRIP before I came here. The same criticism I'm leveling to about where the programs end up. I found that when you are a small business person, I was very happy that you have brought that up. And this is a very important thing for me. When you were a small business person, because you have got no capacity for rent per rent, it's a rent per rent. Sometimes there is a bit of two rent, one rent strategy there. But because you are not capable of bringing the other rent, then it means that whatever ideas you have must die with you there. And I'm just making this comment because I used to try to talk to my colleagues that something must be done in order to change the affairs of poor people, which would be found in the small business community. And I'm very pleased that that has come out. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. Firstly, I think it will be a comment and then perhaps a question. I think it's a well-thought-out business plan which seeks to perhaps address a number of challenges within our national systems of education, and also perhaps to try and bring that, you know, national system of education into some kind of a world-class, you know, system. However, perhaps let me not say however. I do think that the challenge now lies with our public schooling system, which now must be brought in line, you know, with this kind of thinking. Because quite a number of the, you know, students, especially African students, who are majority coming from disadvantaged, areas, who are grappling with a number of problems, including the language, you know, that's where now we have these kind of blockages on one hand. And on the other hand, we have the system, you know, at the end of the year, you know, the grade 12 results that show this wonderful, you know, output, which unfortunately when the same learners, when they get into the universities, it's a different scenario altogether. They don't make the grade. So I think this needs, I know it's something that affects, you know, our portfolio, but at the same time, perhaps it's something that we have no control over. But at some stage, I think there shall have to be very creative intervention, you know, along these lines. Now, as for the question now, the Innovation Fund, I would like to know what you had in mind with the Foundation for Technological Innovation. Did we have in mind perhaps a situation where with all, you know, types of, you know, things that are produced in technology, we would have perhaps some kind of information as to what is produced locally, so that we begin to, you know, encourage people to buy locally. Because I have observed that, you know, simple things like plugs, for instance, the electric plugs, made in China, so that, you know, we don't wake up one day and discover that the same problem that we had in the clothing industry, that our industries now are closing down, you know, because, you know, they have all these kinds of, you know, this notion of dumping notion in that sector. So that's the question. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. One
wanted to do a follow-up on the POVA television. You know, when you come to present in Parliament, you presenting to members of Parliament, which represent various constituencies. Some of them are in cities, some of them are in rural areas. I was not disturbed when the answer was, no, there's nothing that you can see right now, 2007. They will see some time. You know, as a funder, I should think we should be sensitive to what the government is saying. We're saying we intensify the struggle against poverty in 2007. So your business plan should change. For example, why don't you fund a project that I can go back to Uganda, my constituency, and say, now, Parliament is saying we have a research, this type of project that can help you. For example, most of our constituencies, they have a plot, an acre or two. There's nothing growing in there, but nobody's done a research on it. Most of households, they have cattle there. When I was young, I used to make milk 10 liters or so. Now those cattle don't have milk. What is the problem in there? We continue funding projects for commercialization, as my previous speaker said, but nothing that I can go back to report on as a member of parliament to say, this is coming to alleviate poverty. That is the first question. The second question would be just a shorter one. On your the short question on this 8-9 million, I think it's coming back for it since I came here late year now. Now it's 41. How did you reduce it to 41, and what's your strategy to reduce it further to 0 2008? Okay. And then where are you going to get that another shortfall of 1.5 million to? Thanks.
You wanted to add something?
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Chair, just talking to the actual annual report on a business plan, on page 22, it covers expanding intellectual property management activities. It refers to Patent Support Fund, the Patent Incentive Fund, Intellectual Property Chairs, the IP Agency, and then some other funding. I don't understand what these are all about and how one distinguishes between them, if that could just be explained. And I mentioned this in light of one of my constituents who, during the course of last year, developed technology and approached various government agencies. I'm not sure if he approached, or they approached this particular agency or not. But came away with nothing. Developed their technology from family funding, because, fortunately, and we're talking about a business with two black youth, recently graduated from university, one white youth, also from the university, starting the business, with family money. They've come up with a product that I believe is a world leader, and now there's a foreign investor knocking on their door. Can we lose the commercial rights, if not the intellectual property? Can we afford to lose that? I mean, that's the issue, ultimately.
Thank you, members. Just I've got some few comments here, just as a matter of input, because your aim when you come and present these strategic plans here is that we should also give you direction so that during the course of the year, some of the things that you can think through, you incorporate some of the ideas that have been at least proposed here in Parliament. I was, some of the issues have been covered by members, but I just wanted to comment about this SIAP, the Institution of Aquatic Biodiversity. When we had the University of Rhodes, we found that CSIR is running a very big program there under under the university. And we found that it was such a very important program, especially with regard to NEPAD initiatives. And we found that they were saying that, but they are experiencing serious problems in getting support for taking this further, and in particular to even introducing young students into this field of biodiversity. And they said they have had some joint working relations with states like Tanzania, and they've made very big strides, but they could not take it further because they didn't have support. Well, when we introduced that to CSIR, they refuted it because they said they are always wanting to put it like that. But I think these are some of the things, because sometimes denials are not useful if they are destructive. So I'm just putting it, I'm not sure who is speaking the truth between them, or we as committee do not know who is speaking the truth, but probably this is a project that is worth looking into as NRF, because I think it falls very much closer to the objectives as we've outlined in the strategy. Because it's about developing and making, and the way they describe how students have been thrilled in seeing some of those things, the silicon project and so forth. It was even interesting to us. We learned a lot even ourselves. So I think that some projects like those need to be looked into, and even to look outward into cooperation with other African states that may have resources that can be exploited even at commercial level. But they don't have the resources. Another comment that I wanted just to also put here, because I think we are the most appropriate institution to talk to. I have had an appeal from the University of Pretoria. Unfortunately, the deputy minister just left, but he did concur with that appeal to the point that he said he would was ready when we could convene such a brainstorming session between related committees to see through how we can help. But the appeal from the Dean of Veterinary Science in the University of Pretoria is that black students do not want to take veterinary medicine. They only associate it with cows and animals. They do not see its viability beyond farms. And so he said it was a very serious problem, and indeed I've understood that, well, it's their problem, but of course the deputy minister was only the Minister of Agriculture. He has more input, that it's not only that as a problem. But I think therefore we must investigate that as the institution as to how to help the situation. In fact, the dean wanted to come to Parliament and appeal that it's quite a very strategic profession, and I happen to have a friend who is a fertility specialist. At one stage when he described to me how important this veterinary is in terms of breeding and really making and changing the poverty trends, I felt that that is exactly what our students need to understand about veterinary medicine. So I think that you must follow up that and try also to use SASTA to make students understand that this is a very important field. I have also seen some floating. There's been a flowing paper or notice on geoinformatics bursaries. Can you describe what is the strategy? I think they are circulated from CSIR. Can you describe what exactly is the aim? Because there are many other issues. Why necessary geoinformatics? What is it that is into it, if you know? Another important area which I think I found to be, some people have come to me as the show signs and they have said that, why is it that there are no students or even specialists in nuclear medicine? There are very few. And so I saw RMC, how could it be probably utilized in terms of this nuclear medicine? And I'm not sure whether that is even true, but I haven't had that is what has come to my desk, that there is a serious problem about the nuclear medicine specialist, and yet it's one of the strategic professions. There was the member here. Also, I just wanted to make a follow-up to what the member observed about the shortfall of salt of 1.45 million. According to the Institute of Statistics, the total needed was 4.5 million, and we only granted 3 million, and then there was a shortfall of 1.5 million. So that I was put on this question that, you see, sometimes, when it comes to us as Parliament, we are told that this is a project that is going to have so much of spin-offs in terms of capital turnaround. But then when now people come to Parliament and say, we want money, we are running short of, we want to back up this thing, it sometimes confuses us. And now I asked them when they said that they have a problem. Last time they came here, they said they have a problem. I don't know. I think it is this money, because they appeal that there is no money and the structures are deteriorating there in salt, and so we need money. But we said, according to what we told that that project is going to be actually giving spin-offs of about 75 million per year or something like that, or there was some budget like that. So we didn't understand when we told now that you are actually footing the bill and you are running short of money to sustain that project, whatever the reason. So I'm trying to follow up from this member that, can you explain why do you then have a situation like that where now you have to foot the bill when the bill is supposed to give us profits? But there is another important comment also from the University of Pretoria. The University of Pretoria has introduced a new course, which is under their Department of Engineering Management Systems. They've introduced a course on asset management and maintenance engineering, asset management and maintenance systems. They are saying that this course is new because this is a course that actually is going to answer a lot of industrial problems in terms of even power outages, manage assets, and all these things which actually are found to some of our old big industries to be lacking. And so they want to train people in these areas. And I have even introduced them to give us a course along this year in Parliament. And so I was thinking that some of your strategy, because these are things that are directly needed by industry, you have to start focusing on better to train students in that particular field, asset and management system, asset management and maintenance systems. I think that's very important. And another problem also which has been suggested, it's about the problem of skills. That why do we not give, say, amnesty to foreigners, to immigrants, who must be used to diffuse their know-how into our own people here before they leave the country after 2010, so or even whatever time frame that you can look into you as the institution directly assigned to look into these problems. Yeah, so these are some of the last one was, one member Kenya talked about why many of these satellite institutions that seem to be doing one and the same, kind of specialization, such as innovation fund. What is exactly the purpose of the foundation of, you know, what is foundation of technology in innovation versus innovation fund? And you talked about, I have that discussion with the DG about their 10-year plan, actually came with a point that they are looking into all these small institutions that not, they are not talking to each other, to be, try to be coordinated so that they do not duplicate what they do, so that they you know, they have specific role, you know, specific as an enzyme, like I'm doing this because I know someone is doing that, and so I coordinate my activities, which is, I think, part of the program that exists in DST, the governance framework program, which tries to coordinate activities of various institutions in an entity. So I therefore also am trying to find out why are you establishing more entities instead of fusing the entities under the common management. So these are some of my comments and questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. That was a list of questions that came from various points of view. I will invite the members of my delegation to jump in where there are gaps or where there are places for them to comment. The question that was raised by Mr. Blanche over there regarding the PhD production being perhaps not the most advisable way to go as we move forward, and that there are examples that you cited that are very plentiful of how other people have been able to perform without having those PhDs. And in fact, the literature also says that maybe the PhD can be counterproductive, especially when it comes to things like innovation and all that. In fact, the more you learn, not to try, because if you try, it's not going to work according to the theory. In fact, the literature in the area of management science, which I'm trained in, says that, you know, sometimes the best managers are those people who never wanted to be managers, but worked under people who are messing things up so badly that they decided to jump in and become managers without training and made a very good job of it. Examples are some of the people you have mentioned. Bill Gates dropped out of college and went on to become a very, very important person. The other guy that people don't mention, but is the guy of Apple Computer. What is his name again? Steve Jobs. He left college very early and with his friend they created the Apple Computer in a garage. And today, I mean, we talk about iPods and all that kind of thing. The guy is just a maverick. He's a muckraker of the highest order. I mean, he just leaves no stone unturned. So there is an argument we made that the more you study, the more you know, the more you know, the more you forget, the more you forget, the less you know. So why study at all? It's a logical progression. And maybe we should abandon the higher education completely and go that way. But again, I mean, if you take this to an extreme, it might end up actually undercutting the very important purposes we are about here. As notable as the examples that we have cited, sometimes those are really exceptions, and there have to be room for those people. Even as South Africa goes now, we have outstanding people. Lever Brothers, the company I work for, for a long time was headed by Mr. Van Jaarsveld. I think no relation to this. Van Jaarsveld was the chairman of Unilever South Africa. And the company of Unilever, there were scientists, PhDs and all that. The man had only matric. That's all he had. But he was one of the most respected CEOs and chairmen of Unilever in the Unilever world. That's including England and all that. Because the man just was just a maverick. So some people don't need PhDs by their major. My father had a standard 6, but he was one of the most brilliant men I've ever seen. And he did very good things. You would put him in touch with, he went and visited Professor Rachel once, and I thought my father is not going to have anything to say here. But I tell you, my father's knowledge was so broad, and Rachel's knowledge was just physics, you know. So you take him out of that context. My father just ran with it. But I guess, Mr. Blanche, I'm saying that we should allow for all sorts of possibilities into our system of science, system of innovation and knowledge, but also be reminded of who we are. I think that in the NSF, in the NRF, we part of the way that we work is to define what business we are in, and secondly, to define what business we are not supposed to be in, and what other businesses should we be in, given the mandate we were given by the Constitution, the Parliament, the Act of Parliament. We are the national, meaning covering the whole nation, research foundation, and the emphasis is the research part of it. And in order to conduct research and deliver on that point, you have to be on the leading edge, at the leading edge of your the knowledge front that you are working on. And as I said, then you trail the blaze, and in the process of trailing the blaze, you leave a whole lot of byproducts along the way, secondary outcomes that you have. And some of which, as we said, as the chair quite rightly pointed out, there's a base we have in this pyramid that comprises people at all levels of the learning tree we have in South Africa. But we are constantly seeking that which is going to drive us to be at the edge, at the leading edge of this in the competitive environment of South Africa. Many of the examples you gave had to do with innovation. And I think that the more appropriate person to talk to the question of innovation would be Dr. Lottering behind me here, who I'm going to give an opportunity just now. And I think those questions will relate to Honorable Nafoji there on innovation and the assistance to poor communities and so on and so forth, that the best ideas might come from people there on the ground, but sometimes those get bypassed, and if they do come, they get appropriated by other people who then take them up with IPs and apply for patents for them, sometimes overseas people, ideas that were born on the ground. You mentioned the question of cattle, the whole cattle, Nguni cattle process. But the process of picking up ideas from people from the indigenous community is a very important one, and I think Dr. Lottering would probably help us unpack that one, how we plan to do it. The Indigenous Knowledge Systems Program is another one that I quite agree with you, and I agree with the chair that, if we don't take pride and nurture that which is African, and then use that as our launching pad in the global competitiveness, then we'll be left behind in the race of excellence in the world. And that which is African places us in a position where we can be at the top of it, because we can go anywhere in the world. If it comes from Africa, you have to find excellence about it in Africa. I mean, it would be stupid of us to be funding people to be experts on JIT, which is a Japanese system. It's where the Japanese will always beat us in that. If we come up with some concept born in America and think that we can train scientists to be excellent in that, we'll be second to Americans. But if we come up with something as basic as Ubuntu, who can be a leader on Ubuntu in the world and beat indigenous people from Africa about it?
A simple example, the Chinese today, they have their indigenous food, which has become the commercial product of the world, the noodles. The noodles, that's indigenous food of the Chinese people, but today it is the best food in the hotels of the world. We can do it. Thank you very much. Just continue.
Thank you, Chair. I mean, the analogies go on and on and on. I mean, I went to Texas once, and I entered a restaurant. On the menu, they were serving pap and flakes, poodle wors. It turned out that this was an Afrikaner family that had emigrated. They specialize in this kind of food. I mean, it can go anywhere in the world. Nobody can beat, an Afrikaner person from South Africa in pap and flakes. In the true word, that the way that the proper place is cooked. So if we want excellence, we have to build on that which is indigenous to us and hone that skill. That doesn't mean that we mustn't understand JIT and all the other systems. But if we want to be leaders, then we have to do the Nguni cattle farming and that sort of thing and hone on that. On the question of the strip program, I'll ask Albert to elaborate on that and how it affects the small businesses and how the reformulation process is taking place. And I think Dr. Maharaj may also add on to that. Honorable Nyandu, I used Cornell earlier on. Maybe the members would like, why is he calling him Bengi? But we go back a long way with him. So I took the liberty sometimes to use that. But you talk about the program as a bigger problem than just what the NRF is involved in, involving the public schooling system as such, and that creative interventions have to be made in order to address some of the issues we have raised here. You also mentioned the question of the innovation fund and the necessity to protect our people's innovative ideas being nurtured and be allowed to grow in the face of the ever-globalizing world community where borders are porous, where import substitution is a reality, where you can find people, products that are created in workshop, in sweatshop conditions, let's say in Southeast Asia and Vietnam, undercutting the price structures here and on the ground to the extent that the locally brewed products are not able to see the light of day. What do we do with that? And again, that may be something that Dr. Lottering might address. I hope your list is long enough, Dr. Lottering. On the question of public schooling, I think that the efforts that I mentioned that are taking place, the conversations between DOE, DOL, DST, that on behalf of ourselves, DST, Dr. Mjoka is spearheading those efforts, is a very germane kind of question. What kind of schooling syllabuses and interventions do we make in the direction of alleviating poverty and those kinds of things? I think, and also preparing the next generation of learners to get into the higher education system and hit the ground running rather than have to struggle as they try to grapple with the science concepts. The Honorable And Numalo came back again with the alleviation of poverty, which perhaps in my quickness of answer, I may have skimmed over the immediacy of this as of 2007 being the year of the alleviation of poverty. The fact that some things have to be done now, so you can tell the constituency that the following interventions are in place to try and respond to the amount of money we are appropriating today targeted for that. And it is in that regard that perhaps I may have overlooked to mention the fact that we have the focus area programs, one of which is the alleviation of poverty, which are funded on an ongoing basis. And this year, that's becoming a very important aspect of funding those projects that are coming in addressing the question of poverty alleviation this year. But I take your comment also, your question to be a comment too in terms of giving us advice for the way forward that, you need to focus more on this and perhaps be even proactive in terms of the stuff you talked about, cattle that are not delivering the milk in the quantities they used to deliver before, the droughts and everything in the farm. That perhaps you can be do well to become proactive and get projects funded that will result in those outcomes immediately rather than to wait for too long. And Dr. Lottering will probably have to come and chat with her. And of course the veterinary project that the orally chair has talked about, the University of Pretoria is very interesting. We need to address that, and I think that in that context we can work on that. That's a whole, I've said a few things here, perhaps the colleagues can jump in and, respond. We'll be led by Dr. Lotter first and then the rest of you guys.
I think we've got to look at the issues that you raised in the context in which South Africa finds itself. There's a legacy that we have to deal with based upon the system that we lived under. And we also find ourselves in a phase where we've got to be transitioning the economy to a knowledge-based society, which means we're dealing with more than one problem at the same time. In terms of the innovation fund. It links the knowledge that is developed or based within a society with what is required commercially to develop the economy of a country. Now, in terms of technologies that are developed, they package variously. You can have low-tech, medium-tech, high-tech. We should not think of the solutions that are created from a high-tech environment as not being beneficial to the society and the communities that we come from. If we develop a high-tech photovoltaic cell, which is in essence a solar panel meant to address the energy requirements of the country, it can be deployed throughout the country and benefit everybody in the country. If we look at our biodiversity and we start looking at screening our biodiversity for medications against malaria, TB, we are addressing the needs of the population of the country, and particularly the black people of the country. If we look at problems, medical problems in the country, such as cervical cancer and linked with papilloma virus infection, we've got a project that is running that is developing a vaccine against human papillomavirus. So the high-tech solutions themselves can address some of the problems associated with people. Now, the way the Innovation Fund has been set up is to look at applications from the student population, Mr. Blanche, where a student at any level at university can come with an application to the Innovation Fund and say, I have an innovative idea, help me take it forward. We have a program called the National Innovation Competition, which puts the students' ideas against each other from all the institutions in the country, which ends up with an award at the national phase for the students to then take that money, which is $300,000, and plow it into their business idea. Unfortunately, resource constraints have meant that we've got a backtrack from that particular program. We've not been able to run it because we don't have sufficient resources. But conceptually, we ran it for 3 sessions until we had that particular problem. First, in terms of technological innovation, which is our mandate and the suggestions that you make, I agree it is very important for us to look at solutions that are available elsewhere and see how they could be implemented in our community. And we could do that. But again, it's a resource issue. With sufficient resources, we could look at implementing those types of technology and looking at those technologies in the community and moving forward. It's not beyond a reason for us to undertake that particular initiative. And in terms of a targeted, focused approach as to what we do, you're absolutely right that we can engage in a variety of projects and be scattered all over the place in terms of innovation system. And we won't realize the true benefits of the investments that we have made. And focus is essential. And we've had discussions in this week with DST of trying to get a focused approach to what we do. So that thinking is underway as well. On the question of intellectual property, if you're going to engage in the knowledge economy, it means that you're going to compete commercially. You cannot go into the outside world without a secure intellectual property. It's the basis by which you enter the commercial phase. Because of the investments that you make and the possibility that people might copy your invention, your inventive idea. We came up with a program that says of all the intellectual property that's created in the public sector institutions, as the universities and science councils, we'll subsidize the cost 50% of it. That is the patent support fund. So all the universities in the country submit their portfolios. We look at those portfolios, and where there's valid intellectual property, we subsidize the cost 50%. We also assist inventors to secure intellectual property rights in the international market. We also provide incentives for inventors who have registered IP, and it's a cash incentive to an inventor. So we're trying to promote the development of intellectual property and its protection for commercial gain. We also have a fund that targets particularly small businesses and the IP that's created there, particularly in black-owned small businesses, and assisting them to protect their IP for commercial gain. Who have I left out?
Yeah, if you're finished, it's fine. Thank you very much.
thank you very much, Dr. Lottrin, and thank you very much, Chair. On the question that you, Chair, has raised, and it came in different areas too, the whole question of SIAB and what is happening there. You mentioned the program of PSIR, and you mentioned the question of denial being destructive. The cooperation and so on and so forth. Also on the question of the veterinary science and the, you know, cattle breeding and those kinds of efficiencies that are said to be an area that young black researchers don't want to go into. On the question of geoinformatics, the question of asset management, maintenance, and engineering courses. In all this group of activities, I'd like Albert von Yaswell to give a response there. I also ask Romila Maharaj to say something about the scarf skills area after Albert, especially the creative idea, Chair, you mentioned of maybe giving amnesty to foreign nationals to come in and plug in the hole that seemed to exist at that point. And then I would ask Professor Krish Barutram to answer the question about the nuclear medicine and the MRMC and how that, you know, would evolve after Romila. And then Bishan Singh, I'd like you to talk to the question of the 4.5 million request versus the 3.0 allocated with a shortfall of 1.5 in the face of the fact that some of these programs were approved with the view that they would be self-sustaining in the future. Why are we asking more funding, if you can elaborate on that? And the 89 million to down to 41 million, the management of the post-retirement medical benefit was the other question. So I'll put those two to you. So beginning with Albert, and then Romila, and then Chris, and then Bishan, that in that order. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, thank you for this opportunity, and thank you for bringing all those things to my attention. I think some of them are. Yeah, you know, ongoing academic competition is a reality of life that we have to deal with, as you well know. But I can just report about the South African Institute for Aquatic Biodiversity and the CSIR collaboration is that we have managed to establish a bridge in that collaboration in the context of we now, one of the multi-institutional centers of excellence we've established is the Center for Invasion Biology, which is actually positioned at Stellenbosch University, but it's got tentacles in all sorts of institutions. And what we've managed to do is to ensure that those two institutions, the CSIR and SIAB, are now actively collaborating under the banner of the Center for Invasion Biology. So I hope where the problems were, we tried to address them, but certainly we keep our ear on the ground about developments in that particular area. As far as the veterinary science issue is concerned, Chair, I think somebody that comes from a zoological background, I share there are very real concerns in this regard. You know, veterinary science used to be a science strength of this country many, many years ago. And I'm talking 50 years ago, not the recent past. And it has certainly deteriorated since then. And we don't even feature, I think, in the global landscape in terms of quality of veterinary science that we perform. Whereas we face some of the most major problems in veterinary science right in our doorstep, just in terms of the disease profile that we have to manage and our cattle around, and Eugene addressed some of those issues. So I think this is an area of very real concern. I think if one of the programs in the NRF is one that's run by Dr. Maharaj, and I'll ask her to expand about that a little bit,
is the knowledge field development. In other words, where we identify particular fields that we feel are underdeveloped and are not performing adequately, we as an institution take some of our money and we put it in a pot and we say, ask the community to come up with a strategy as to how they're going to develop that particular field of knowledge. And I think this may be a case in point where that is, that sort of intervention is actually required.
Now, just at this point, the deputy president and chiefs, I think I've got some papers that have just come from Japan. I think you must tap into that. But they have made some agreement with the Japanese on material medicine. And I think you must try and check the details and how to go about it, because I saw that that is part of the address of the problem.
Thank you for that, and we'll tap into that. I think the issue of asset management, the engineering degree that you've had, is precisely the same sort of area. This is an emerging problem in the country in terms of asset management, that we have to develop the skills to take us forward and ensure our infrastructure is maintained and managed in a sensible way into the future. And again, there's probably an intervention where knowledge field development investments from our side can actually make the right kind of contribution. Just to give you an indication, we presently in serious discussions with the people from the medical industry also about the strength and development of strength in clinical medicine, which is another area that we've identified that I think we need to concentrate on. So we have a strategy in place, we have a funding mechanism in place. All we need to do is to engage with these communities and develop an appropriate way forward to make sure that those holes are plugged in our armor and make sure that we become stronger in those areas. The last... was that it, Madama, for me? I can, as far as I can...
That
was it. Thank you. Thank you, sir. Yeah. Sorry, the one thing is the geoinformatics, sorry, that's the one thing I was asked to comment on. I'm not 100% familiar with what's going on there. This is not a bursary scheme where NRF is a partner. We don't provide the bursaries. I think this is run under the Maraca Institute, and maybe my DSD colleagues can help me out here, where the Maraca Institute develops, finds block funding from the Department of Science and Technology. They develop particular skills that they identify, and I think that initiative was part of the development of skills in the Maraca Institute context of the CSR.
Of course, the DGA can comment on that.
I think through your chair, it's part of the implementation of the national ICT R&D strategy, which I think might have been presented to the portfolio committee. As you know, Maraca Institute is the implementing unit at a CSIR for the strategy. Emanating from the strategy, then it's a number of different areas of focus, and that is one of them. So providing bursaries and so forth is a way of bringing in new blood into this particular focus area. Yeah. Thanks.
I'll ask just members to be patient to finish up, and you know, we've run out of time, but that means this discussion has been very interesting. We've spilled over our time long time ago. Because we're sitting at 2. So if the incoming responders, they can just summarize their responses. So I'll be glad.
Thank you, Chair. Dr. Maharaj, and then Dr. Krishna, and then Bishop. That order,
please. Okay. I'll just comment briefly, and we can chat further over lunch if members are interested in finding out more. I just want to comment on the TRIP issue quickly. We've certainly identified the difficulties that the SMMEs experience in being able to participate in the program, and we've been engaging with the DTI to develop a parallel model which will facilitate easier access and hopefully also a quicker turnover time, because they're really not in a position to wait for 1.5 or 2 years for funding. The Department of Labor Skills, we do have a partnership program with the Department of Labor. Currently, they're funding bursaries in the order of around 50 million per annum, and these bursaries are not simply awarded without any framework. There are a number of specific areas that the Department of Labor has identified as scarce skill areas, and also targets that are set, say 80% black students and about 50% women as well. Dr. Vinyasa mentioned the new knowledge fields, which doesn't fall under my directorate, but that is one mechanism that we do use for directing research activities in emerging areas. But we've also launched a new program last year, and this is the first year that we're funding, called Research Niche Areas. So we've gone through an extensive process of engagement with the institutions to find out areas that align themselves with national priorities, regional needs, and institutional strengths. And that also provides another mechanism for developing new research areas in line with the needs of the country.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to address the question that you raised, Chair, about the lack of students in UK Med. Now, we are also very seriously aware of this and very aware of the serious problem. At the moment, nuclear medicine training is offered at the Medical University of South Africa, which is now, I think, part of the University of Limpopo, at FITS, at Pretoria, at UCT, and Stellenbosch offers radiation oncology. This has been one of the main motivation, in fact, behind the MRMC, that we see it as being in partnership with universities and the facilities in the region as well as in the rest of the country to offer the comprehensive training all the way from photon therapy to proton therapy and, of course, using radioisotopes, which is the basis of nuclear medicine. And what we have done at Itamba is to put Professor Mike Sateka, who's Professor of Nuclear Medicine at the University of Pretoria. He's on the advisory council to the director of the Itamba Labs. And also, in fact, the chairperson of the advisory council is Dr. Trevor Mdaka, who is also a nuclear medicine expert. And so certainly their input will inform the strategies that we adopt in trying to increase the intake of students, also to increase the expertise that we have in the country. It is quite a great situation because at the Itamba Labs we advertise the post for head of medical physics for the last 3 years, and we couldn't find a suitable candidate. I had a meeting just quickly also with the DVC research at UCT. At UCT, they advertised for Professor of Nuclear Medicine for 2 years, and the post hasn't been filled. So we are working together and trying to see what solutions we can come up with.
So, actually, that is why this was even raised by the chair of caucus, of our caucus, and he was saying that actually, I don't know, there's a child who has a problem of nuclear medicine, but they are not even specialists to our hospital to take the child to. I think they have said that there are only 3 people in the country, that's what she told me. And he was saying that these are type of the food that we have to develop. Why are we not developing them? So it was under the context that I asked the question.
Thank you, Chris. I just wanted to say here, this is exactly the kind of example, Chair, you're asking about, where there's a void of skilled people to occupy certain positions. Shouldn't there be this program of amnesty for foreigners to be brought in to fill that gap there? And that's a typical example. Again, wait for 3 years with nobody responding that has the qualifications. Actually, Chair, just to incept this point before Vision talks about the financing at source. The whole question of bringing foreign nationals to South Africa, the Research Chairs Initiative that has been launched recently is one attempt to do this, to make South Africa competitive by offering researchers from all over the world in those key areas we want to have expertise in. An example being that this SKA we're trying to bid for. So we have research chairs at different universities that package the offering so that it's attractive for these top researchers to come into South Africa in those areas we'd like to build excellence in and sow the seeds and perhaps in a contract way so that by 2010, as you mentioned, at the time when they are going back home, they left a whole group of people who can then take over who are indigenous and are based here in South Africa. So that's a very important program, and I'm sure Dr. Sitapalo is aware of the efforts we have made in that. And finally, Vision Singh, who is the CFO of the NRF, would take us through the logics of the shortfalls and how we have handled those and how they impact on us.
Thank you. Firstly, I think when we enter into collaborative arrangements like the SALT and the SK, it's very important for us to understand what these arrangements entail. SALT was inaugurated in 2005. Certainly, SALT is not a self-sustaining telescope. The arrangement behind SALT is that the partners who funded SALT initially would sustain the activities and the operations of SALT. Now, South Africa holds 37% shareholding in SALT. The challenge that was put up on that slide pertained to the fact that the MTS allocation made provision for 3 million rand over 3 years, and every year that then gives you the new figure for the future years. With the inauguration of SALT in 2005, SALT has now become active and is now engaging in science. As a result, the commissioning of SALT has resulted in an increased level of activity, and the operational costs of SALT have increased. In discussions with the SALT board and the activities that are planned to enhance SALT, the levies have consequently also increased. The NRF portion has increased from 3 million rand to 4.5 million rand. That representation was made to the DST in the MTS submission that we made in July of last year. So therefore, in receiving the allocation letter, we found that there was a shortfall of 1.5 million rand. However, that did not just sit there. We've had discussions. I've raised the matter with the director of finance there, the CFO at DST, as well as the DDG of governance. So it's a matter that is being discussed, and I'm sure we will find an amicable solution to that. However, what is critical in that is the understanding of how that collaborative arrangement works. That's the first part on the deficit or the shortfall with regard to the 1.5 million rand on the SALT. The second aspect with regard to the funding of the post-retirement healthcare liability, this is a thorny issue, Chairman, and certainly has been lingering around for quite some time now. You will recall that in the past discussions and the past presentations that we've made to yourself, that this matter was raised. The NRF board, coming in as the new board, has decided, as the accounting authority of the NRF, that they will no longer continue to accept the fact that we will not find a solution to this problem. In so doing, we've had discussions with the DDG in November last year. We've had commitments from the DDG, from the DG of DST, to take this case further on behalf of ourselves to the National Treasury. However, we are delighted in the fact that the DG has also engaged his people around in the DST and come up with some funds before the 31 of March this year. In our response to that positive reaction that we've received, we've also decided to set aside some level of funding within the funding that we have in the NRF. However, that liability also grows, Chair. In so doing, what we have decided in the NRF is also to portion off savings that we would materialize within the NRF so that we could, over a three-year period, alleviate and completely eliminate this liability. That three-year plan we have submitted through to the DG at the DST. It happened about a week or two ago. We are optimistic that we will be able to, in a shared partnership with the DST and representation through to National Treasury, alleviate that liability over a three-year period. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, it's just that it sounds very unpalatable from the side of Parliament when we hear that the projects which was promised to us that they are going to spend money, they now are absorbing money from us. And they are becoming a liability. So however you say it, the people on the street, these are the questions they ask in our constituencies. That we don't have jobs, why did you engage in that? Because the local now you want more money is going to that instead of helping us. So these are type of questions because they don't sit and listen to how you explain it. They just understand from papers that yeah, that project wants more money from government now, which is unsustainable and so forth. So these are type of the things that we must be sensitive to. I'll give the CEO to wrap up.
On behalf of the NRF and members of the Department of Science and Technology, I wish to thank the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee on Science on listening to us and accepting our plan, and express my appreciation for all the comments that were given to us and the care in which they were articulated. We appreciate the enrichment of the vision we have. That will go a long way towards getting us to that point of helping the nation in the ways that we discussed here today. Obviously, the path we are charting is not going to be a linear path. It's going to have to veer one way or the other to accommodate the emerging realities on the ground. But I hope that with your help, we will keep plodding along the path that leads us to where we want to eventually end. The differences of opinion are a natural way in which we kind of diversify our base of knowledge so that we come up with more creative solutions to the problems at hand. We have to go back to the question of funding, because as a science council ourselves, we depend on the good graces of the members of the committee here to advocate for us and help us in steering the course throughout. Several ideas that came out, you know, among which is the idea that we've got to keep talking across a broad spectrum of science councils or organizations within the science system in South Africa, and we will continue to do that. And as I said, we as the new incoming top management of the organization, we are dedicated to carrying out on the mandate that you have told us or given us through the Act of Parliament to be able to deliver to the South African society. Hopefully in the long run we will accomplish some of these things, perhaps not in our time, maybe not even in our term, but by remaining focused on the task at hand. As they usually say, you know, we will shoot for the moon, but hopefully if we miss the moon we'll land among the stars. And that's not a bad place to be. With that, I want to thank you very much. And Chair, on behalf of the NRF, I'd like to hand over this report to you.
Thank you very much, Professor Mungadis. On behalf of the committee also, I would wish to thank everybody who has taken all the effort to come down here. But I just want to stress one important point before you leave, that it's not always a problem of money, because we've got records all over here where monies have been received but underspent. So it's not always money. So what you should promise us is that the money that you have, you are going to utilize it exactly for the strategic plans that you have given us here, because they seem very wonderful and coordinated with the input from members. We can start to make a difference. But in my experience, since I came to Parliament, people talk very nice language when they come here during the strategic plan presentation, and nothing comes of it at the end of the year. When you ask at the end of the year, they come for annual reports, they have not done anything. Monies are remaining, there are vacancies, but yet They say they are running short of specialists. You find that in their department there are so many vacancies, people are not employed. There are so many CVs floating around us here, who want work, who still seem to be qualified. So it's a very complex problem. If it was a solution probably of one committee, would have long solved this problem. But we know that the promises that are good, that are being made, or the blame on the shortage of finances is not usually the case at the end, because if you go to the coffers of the departments that come here, you will find that there is a lot of money underspent, and how do you account for that? You see? So this is a type of thing. But fortunately, our department is one of the few, if not only two, that have spent almost all the money according to parliamentary records, which has been a very high year in parliament. So it means that we really do things that we say in our department, and I want you to really keep that record up. Do things as you say them, and we expect when you come back at the end of the year that things that you have said you will implement, you will have started to say at least we have these few results, here are the challenges, again we'll share ideas to see how to go about with those things and keep on supporting you in the treasury to get more money. With that, thank you very much. There is lunch, I'm sure it's very cold now, but you can participate and partake of it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll just photocopy everything and I'll photocopy the new presentation and we don't have it. Do you want to shut down to me? I'll photocopy all this. And then what we'll do, like right now, we'll need to move them back and copy. Yeah.